Turn to domestic politics this morning after what feels like a rather lengthy hiatus examining the descent of Donald Trump's United States into textbook fascism. No imminent sign of anything similar happening here, but there are perhaps some signs in the tea leaves. I think I want to talk about Labour and the Andy Burnham debacle and the rationale now provided by Downing Street for behaving in a way that looks at best petulant and at worst pathetic, and I'm tempted also to have a look at this new outfit being formed under the Conservative umbrella and wonder with you which of the two is in more trouble.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the Home Secretary has defended the use of a former military barracks in East Sussex to house asylum seekers. Up to 500 men could be placed at Crowborough training camp. The local authority is considering legal action against the plans. But speaking to LBC, Shabana Mahmood says she understands the strength of feeling from local residents.
I know that as we expand the use of military sites, we will see similar issues elsewhere. But we do have to find a solution. I think moving to larger sites rather than hotels, you know, on high streets and rooted in local communities. I think military sites presents a better solution. Look, I know this is difficult. Yes. There are no easy answers here and there is no one silver bullet. I wish that there were that I could implement and make these problems go away overnight.
The Home Secretary has also admitted the majority of policing reforms announced yesterday won't be rolled out until 2030. Shabana Mahmood says she is confident, though, that Labour will secure another term in government to deliver the plans. In other news this morning, the King and Queen will host a reception at Buckingham Palace later to mark Holocaust Memorial Day. They'll be joined by survivors and their families on the 81st anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Daniel Walker is the rabbi of the Manchester synagogue where worshippers were killed in a knife attack last October. He's told LBC that resilience and positivity shown by his congregation is helping the healing process.
In many ways, I'm trying to forget large amounts of it as part of my own personal journey. Okay. But of course I do remember it very, very, very vividly. And I remember the bravery of people, of good people, and I remember the response of good people, and that heartens me.
Flooding from Storm Chandra has led to major travel disruption this morning. Several roads have been closed and rail services have been affected in the southwest of England. At least 30 flights at Belfast City Airport have been cancelled. The ferry operator Stena Lines cancelled a number of sailings. Sir Keir Starmer will travel to China later, the first visit there by a prime minister in 8 years. Last week, the UK government granted Beijing permission to build the biggest embassy in Europe in London. And ground rents will be capped at £250 a year in England and Wales as part of major housing reforms. New leasehold flats will be banned and existing leaseholders will get the right to switch to common hold. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 23 at 10,173. The pound buys $1.36 and €1.15. LBC weather, Storm Chandra will bring heavy rain and strong winds which will push north and east with hill snow in the north as well. Turning drier in the south this afternoon, a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Tuesday night on the sofa, watching telly with Mum. Again.
Male hawkers stay with the mothers for life.
This is the moment Stephen chose to speak to Barclays about Mortgage Boost, so he could borrow more with help from family or friends. We're helping first-time buyers get on the property ladder sooner. Search Barclays Mortgages. Barclays. Make money work for you.
Your home may be repossessed if you do not keep up repayments on your mortgage. Subject to application, financial circumstances and borrowing history. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 10. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where, all being well, we will be returning to the domestic political landscape today. Be careful what you wish for. It's a wise words of caution, aren't they? Because it ain't pretty. The situation in America, in the United States of America, continues to shock some warmth perhaps to be garnered from the scale of the opposition, the scale of the protests to the cold-blooded murder of the ICU nurse, Alex Pretty, but 3,000 officers and agents deployed. It looks like this Bonvino character may carry half a can for it. But remember, Trump doesn't do anything out of principle or conscience. He does everything out of self-interest. So if his calculus, if his personal political calculus at the moment is that they need to dial down the fascism, he'll dial it down, but briefly, and it will soon be dialed straight back up again. Don't waste any time now wondering whether those words are accurate or these descriptions are sound. You've had it proved too many times to quibble. Now, here's part of the problem that Labour has at the moment. That was a really good story in the news there. I don't even know if you noticed it, about leasehold, a ban on new leaseholds, a change to legislation. England and Wales are pretty much the only countries in the world where you can somehow own and not own your property. But I don't know whether or not it is going to... I mean, is it going to excite anybody? Is anybody going to this morning be galvanised by news regarding leasehold contracts? And that, if you were to commit yourself briefly to assembling a warm analysis of where the current government is, and I hope you won't think less of me for suggesting that that's quite a difficult thing to do at the moment. Not impossible, but quite a difficult thing to do at the moment. You would find yourself pointing to relatively dry detail and things that change people's lives but which don't feel hefty. So you heard the Home Secretary earlier today unveiling policing reforms. That sounds very big, but the more you dig into the detail, the harder it is to stay to keep grasp of what is actually destined to happen. A lot of what they're doing almost goes in the opposite direction. It's actually in the detail that you find the benefits, that you find the goods and the positives, but they don't lend themselves to massive headlines. They don't lend themselves to big tent announcements. We're tackling the problems with leaseholds. It's something that no one has ever marched to war under, a banner that nobody has ever marched to war under. And that, it seems to me, is part of the problem. The stuff that they do well doesn't really resonate, whether because of media problems or something that runs a little bit deeper or communications problems coming out of Downing Street. And the stuff that they do badly just happens again and again and again. And that brings us back to the story of the week, which is Sir Keir Starmer's decision to block Andy Burnham from returning to Westminster. Here is the rationale, the reason why they have done it. They expect to lose the by-election that will be called as a consequence of Andrew Wynne stepping down. They expect to lose it even if Andy Burnham runs. And they would rather lose a by-election than lose the mayoralty. So if Andy Burnham pulls out of the mayoralty, resigns from that job 2 years after accepting it, runs for Parliament and loses because the threat posed by the Greens and by Reform is high, very high, very real possibility that Labour could be pushed into third place in Gorton, and I don't know how much magic Andy Burnham brings to a by-election. I really don't, actually, and we may need calls from Manchester on that to fill us in on whether or not he carries a cachet akin to the one that Boris Johnson carried in London for many years and that Sadiq Khan carries today. Traditional Labour territory, though, both cities. So perhaps Johnson being more of an anomaly than Sadiq Khan. You've got around 50 Labour MPs signing a letter objecting to the decision. But I want to know what you think. In a way, I want to know whether you would sign it. The mood among the party grassroots is being described as febrile in the wake of the decision, which means that our job is to look at why it was done. And I don't know whether this is me being a little bit glass half full or whether it is, as in looking for positives in obvious negatives, or whether it is actually the grown-up and important thing to do, which much of the media won't do because it doesn't lend itself to this addiction that we have to drama. We are all addicted to drama. We have been since 2016, probably. The political diet prior to 2016, even with austerity, was much much more beige than the political. I quite like beige food, but I'm British after all. But it was a much more beige political. We didn't know it was, but you think of the big flare-ups and the gaps between them. You know, I mean, international foreign wars, obviously, but also, you know, things like the poll tax, the moment, or the toppling of Margaret Thatcher, two events that were actually linked, or Michael Heseltine's resignation from the cabinet. These moments of high drama merit several chapters in politics textbooks. The textbooks covering the last 10 years, these sort of dramas are barely going to merit a page because another one will be along tomorrow. And it is that addiction to drama that I think explains some of the coverage of moments like this. One Labour MP said of the block on Andy Burnham, I suspect most of the parliamentary party will back the decision. The problem will come when we lose the by-election. The MP predicted that Labour would finish third at best, with the Greens and Reform UK fighting it out to win. If they lose that, I would suggest that Starmer is in all sorts of trouble. So what I want to examine today is the simple question of what you think about what the Prime Minister did. There's no point arguing that it wasn't his individual decision. The NEC has moved with Keir Starmer, albeit that his deputy offered up the single and solitary vote in favour of letting Andy Burnham stand. The rationale is that losing a by-election is better than losing the mayoralty. So the calculation is, if we have an election for mayor of Greater Manchester, we will lose it. And that is a much bigger surrender of power for the Labour Party than losing a by-election in a constituency that will barely make, well, it won't make a dent in the size of our majority. So think about all the moving parts here. That's moving part number one, is losing the mayoralty. And that being a much bigger deal. It's a much bigger job than being an MP. That's why Andy Burnham does it. So that is the risk. That is the belief that we will lose the mayoralty, and we don't want to run that risk, so we will run the risk of losing a by-election. That's the second moving part, because the odds are at the moment that they will lose that by-election. I think we learnt from Plaid Cymru down in Caerphilly that you can never say never in by-elections, but I don't know that you've got, with the possible exception of the Greens, I don't know that you've got the kind of wild card of a resurgent Plaid Cymru. So the second moving part is the by-election, which they also at the moment think they're probably going to lose. So they're choosing between a rock and a harder place. They're concluding that losing the mayoralty is a harder place than the rock. So they've gone for that. But if they then lose that by-election, which they think they're going to do, Keir Starmer's position becomes, well, fragile. And the calculation to risk losing the mayoralty will pale into the background, even if the calculation was correct. You know, the risk of losing the mayoralty of Manchester is now off the table. So nobody is going to respond to a loss in the by-election by saying, oh, well, at least we didn't lose the mayoralty, because that hasn't been crystallised. It hasn't become a real enough prospect for people to actually put it on the scales when assessing whether or not running the risk of and then losing a by-election was the correct thing to do. And then you've got the backbench rebellion, which is, as with all backbench rebellions, close to immeasurable. You can count the 50 signatures on the letters. You can count the 50 signatures on the letter objecting to the decision to block him from standing. But I mean, some people might have signed that after lunch. Some people might have signed it in a fit of pique. Some people might have signed it in blood, so passionate are their feelings. Some people might have signed it with a little bit of a meh, or they sign everything that causes trouble for the current leadership. So this is, compared to the conversations that we've had in the last week, this is quite dry territory. And I'm not going to lie to you, I'm glad. I think there is only so much chronicling of the decline of Western civilization that you can do as a human being. There are days when you don't look away, you certainly don't close your eyes, you don't start ignoring what is going on, but you remember that even as America falls, the rest of the world continues to turn, and the United Kingdom remains, for now at least, relatively insulated from the forces of fascism that are on the march in Minneapolis and elsewhere. Better to lose Gorton than to lose the mayoralty, but as David has already suggested, better to lose the mayoralty than to lose number 10. And that's your third or fourth moving part. So, what do you think? I mean, are you in the mood for how much trouble is Keir Starmer in? Because I think the writing's on the wall now for him. I don't see how people can be expected to march into battle behind him anytime soon in a general election. I could be wrong, but I just find myself quite sadly, to be honest with you, because as I say about beige food and dullness, the very easily and quickly forgotten madness of the last 14 years should be set in relief to, but the problem was you wanted calm competence, didn't you? And you don't feel that you're getting it. You might be getting calmness, but you don't feel that you're getting competence. So has Keir Starmer done the least bad thing in the circumstances? This was the phone-in that we were going to have at 12 o'clock yesterday until someone moved from the right to the far right. I forget their name. More on that later in the programme. And that is the conversation that I want to have with you, because I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you see this. I know how I see it, and I genuinely see it as he's probably done the right thing, but it's still awful. And those are the moments where you feel support for any politician or even any football manager seeping away. You recognise the difficulty of the situation that they find themselves in. You acknowledge that a lot of those difficulties are self-inflicted. An awful lot of the problems that the government currently faces are self-inflicted, most obviously in the context of policy reversals. One or two makes them look good and look like they're listening. Eight or nine makes them look a little bit daft and increasingly ridiculous. The reason why he can't be a mayor and an MP, as Boris Johnson was for a while, is because he's also the PCC. The Mayor of London is currently not the Police and Crime Commissioner, but the Mayor of Manchester is. So he can't hold both jobs. Do you know, I asked Jim Waterson that yesterday from London Centric when he was in to talk to us about that amazing story involving TikTok, because I knew he'd know. He's that kind of character. I didn't know. But now you do. And it means that the notion of there being a good option was removed. There is no win here. Every single thing that Starmer could do from the moment that Andy Burnham announced that he wanted to run for Parliament again, every single thing that he could do was a bad option. Is there a word for that? Is it Hobson's choice? You know, there are three or four paths he can go down, and every single one of them takes him to a place that is worse than the place he started out from. You know, he looks frightened by not letting Burnham stand, but he keeps a Labour mayor in power in Manchester by not letting Burnham stand. He looks vulnerable if he lets Burnham stand, but he runs the risk of Burnham not winning the by-election, which is the worst of all possible worlds. This is the one line of defence I'd offer up for him, although I am, as you can probably tell, edging ever, ever closer to deciding that it's time for Starmer to be replaced. The one thing I would say is a fairly big obstacle to going for him on this occasion is that he's probably done the thing that a utilitarian would advise. Do I need to explain what utilitarianism is? To myself, not to you. I know you know. Just remind myself what utilitarianism is. It's almost as if you turn everything into a calculation and you leave emotion at the door. And what you do is essentially, it's where that phrase for the greater good comes from. Most 19th century philosophy was dedicated, or at least continental philosophy, was dedicated to trying to replace religion, to find a moral code that could replace a kind of slavish devotion to ancient texts and religion. So, you know, you've got Kant's golden rule, which kind of boils down to do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. But utilitarianism, Jeremy Bentham and John Stuart Mill finessed, was the idea that you just calculate, you almost have units called utiles, and you add up how many pluses would be created by doing something and how many negatives, and then you remove the negatives from the pluses, and what you're left with, however negative, is the best available option. And that's why I think that blocking Andy Burnham for a utilitarian was the right thing to do. But of course, that's only one school of philosophy. It might be for the greater good, but A, you might not see it that way or feel it that way, and B, that might be true today. Will it be true by the end of February when they've lost a by-election in traditional Labour heartlands? So there it is, 0345 6060 9 73. Keir Starmer has blocked Andy Burnham. I don't want to have a phone-in about whether Andy Burnham would be a better leader than Keir Starmer. We may have to have that phone-in at some point, but it's off the table now, which is another moving part that particular threat to his leadership has been removed. Of course, if you want threats to his leadership, you're not going to see that as a positive, which is where the problems with utilitarianism come in. But if you're Keir Starmer calculating Keir Starmer's utility, then this was probably the right thing to do. Until you drive a coach and horses through my carefully constructed and surprisingly philosophical analysis. That's what I meant by being a little bit relieved that we're not talking about nurses being murdered on the streets of our cities by law enforcement officers in cold blood. Sometimes you've got to remember how lucky you are. 0345 6060973 is the number you need to talk to me about British politics and whether or not Keir Starmer has done the right thing in blocking Andy Burnham and what the ripple effect or the ramifications of this decision will be in your view. It's 10:19.
LBC.
From rusty chains to fancy frames and everything in between. Sign up for British Heart Foundation's iconic London to Brighton bike ride. Because it's not your wheels, it's how you use them. Whether you're a brand new rider or seasoned pro, challenge yourself this June and make your ride matter with British Heart Foundation. And you won't need any fancy gear, just your helmet and your bike. Sign up today, search London to Brighton bike ride and keep us beating.
Unfold a world of on-the-go entertainment with the Samsung Galaxy Z Fold 7. The massive 8-inch main screen means you'll see the bigger picture as every exciting moment unfolds. Share every highlight and keep the whole family entertained wherever you go. Buy yours now and claim £300 cashback. Conveniently available to spend in your Samsung wallet. Purchase before January 29th from a participating retailer. Claim on the Samsung website within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply.
This is not just food. This is 100% British, 5% fat beef mince. Now for just £5.20. Hang on, 100% British for £5.20? Down from £6.75. That can't be right. Oh, it says here that this is the Remarksable Value range. Over 100 family favourites that are the same M&S quality but at everyday low prices. Well, looks like this is not just food. This is M&S Remarksable Value food. Subject to availability.
The Virgin Atlantic Holiday Sale is now on. This is your sign to dive into the crystal water of an ancient cave pool in Mexico. Or dry off in the sun on a white sand beach in the Maldives. Or pour yourself into the culture and chaos of a night market in Thailand. Seize the sale. Book in store and online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected travel dates apply. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com/terms.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
It is 22 minutes after 10, and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where we turn our attention with a surprising sense of relief to domestic politics and the challenges highlighted, revealed, and not necessarily met by Keir Starmer's decision to block Andy Burnham from standing for Parliament in a by-election set to unfold next month. Let's dive straight into the call, shall we? Martin is in Newark. Martin, what would you like to say?
I'd like to say that I think Keir Starmer did the right thing, pretty plainly. I think one of the weird things that people aren't talking about right now is one of the great Labour MPs of our time that didn't get elected at the last election is Jonathan Ashworth.
Yeah.
He's from Greater Manchester. If you could get Jonathan Ashworth campaigning with Andy Burnham for this seat...
Has anyone spoken to him? Has he broken cover at all?
No, he hasn't spoken yet at all. And I imagine that's part of the point is they need to get Andy Burnham to be quiet.
Yes.
And Andy Burnham, with all due respect, not a great minister when he was in government.
I'm going to lose this battle, aren't I? I lost it with the first call yesterday. I said, I don't want to phone in about whether Andy Burnham should replace Keir Starmer. I want to phone in about...
When he was in Parliament,
yes.
You go back to the last time he was in Parliament, and he had three briefs in about 3 years. He didn't stick to a job. And although he likes to complain and is a critic, he can do that as mayor. That's perfectly fine. Sadiq Khan is a brilliant critic.
He is, actually.
Of Keir Starmer.
That's very true.
The point of having these mayors is so that they have more autonomy to make arguments, a bit like the devolution argument was in the first place. to have people throwing good ideas at the government. And what happened last year around the time of the Labour Party conference, Andy Burnham made a series of moves that got costed out, and people concluded they were daft.
There's a funny thing. I was looking at a graph this morning about the relationship between voting patterns and education in the United States, and I got a little bit excited about it. And then the brilliant Professor Jonathan Portes at King's College responded to my post, pointing out that it was probably not quite as sweeping as I thought. But I've got that in the back of my mind when I almost make it sound like a criticism when I say to you that you're very informed. Does that translate on the ground? I mean, the feelings probably are going to be more important than the utilitarian calculations. People, I mean, Keir Starmer is at the bottom of a very deep hole, and some days it looks like he's still digging. Andy Burnham, if not a clean skin, is close to being a clean skin, which is what Boris Johnson discovered a run as mayor can do. You can wash off a lot of legacy and a lot of history, and of course a lot of association with previous leaderships and previous party administrations. And people who just want a change will think that not letting Andy Burnham at least potentially pose one is a big mistake and quite weak.
I would say in response to that, Keir Starmer, when he ran for the general election with the Labour Party, did so hoping for a 10-year plan of national renewal. That was what he kept on saying. And people elected the Labour government on those terms. Now, he's had not quite 2 years
of
a five-year parliament. And one of the big points that the whole cabinet was saying, as they were the shadow cabinet, is people need to see politicians delivering on promises. Now, we are an impatient culture at the moment. The internet has made us crazy. But if by the time of the next election, Keir Starmer has managed to deliver on his key manifesto pledges and can say, look, we made some mistakes along the way, but we did what we promised we would do.
And then start this list of things, which I realised after reaching for the new legislation on leaseholds, I kind of talk about every day without realising it, in that a lot of the Labour wins are good stories but not topics. So it's all very well me moaning about everybody being addicted to drama and this one doesn't have headline written all over it. But actually, how many times do I say to you, that's a really important story, but it's not a phone-in topic, or at least I haven't got the skills to turn it into a phone-in topic. And the news regarding leaseholds, I think, fits very much into that category. If that list becomes longer, it becomes a headline. And in fact, to tally with what Martin has said, a couple of messages speaking to this theme. I actually am, writes Beatrice, starting to think that Starmer is getting on top of the job of Prime Minister, and now is not the time to get rid of him. I think he's doing a really good job of steering the UK through international choppy waters, and is doing it so well with Jonathan Powell that we don't recognise how stormy it is and how good a skipper Starmer is being internationally. Another message, which I've managed to lose, suggested that he may have been distracted by the illness and loss of his brother in the first year of his premiership. I'm always a little bit wary of digging too deep on the sort of psychological analysis, but the sense that the scale of the mess, this is the thing about the reform defections. Has ever a word missed a vowel as desperately as the word defection misses a vowel in the context of reform, people joining reform? But this is where they're so baffling, or at least so dispiriting, the policies, the politics, and the people responsible for the mess that Keir Starmer found when he arrived in Downing Street are all now setting themselves up as having had nothing to do with creating the mess that they created, and somehow being the people that should be trusted to fix it. I mean, it is truly breathtaking, but that is where we are. And that is one of the things that Beatrice suggests, I think, that we should be taking into account when critiquing Keir Starmer. Alan is in Wandsworth, no ordinary Alan, a former Labour campaigns director. What's going on here, and is it the right course, albeit no one's going to claim that it's a good course to be on?
Good morning, James. Yes, he took the right decision. It's the only decision he could have taken, and it was the correct one in the circumstances.
Why?
There's no guarantee that Andy Burnham would have won the by-election. That would have led to the mayoral election. There's no guarantee Labour would have won that election. But even more important than that, it's taking the voters for granted. These voters elected Andy Burnham for a term of office that runs out in 2028. It's also rumoured that were Andy to become the mayoral candidate and create a vacancy in Manchester, yeah. one of the MPs in the area would become the candidate in Manchester, thus creating another parliamentary by-election. And so it goes on. And these are politicians that are using voters as pawns. They're taking them for granted in their own personal
You're talking ambitions. About Andy Burnham now.
Well, yes, he hasn't thought this through properly. He's thinking about his own ambition. He's not thinking about the voters. And all too often, politicians do forget the voters when it comes to their own ambitions. I kind of get it, because it's a big old greasy pole, and yeah. they come into politics with an ambition and think they can do well, and they have egos, and I get it. But the bottom line is, it's the voters who put them there. But the Tories did it time after time.
Yeah,
in their leadership elections.
You've got a point. Do we know how deeply voters feel this? Because I do think the one bit missing from a lot of the Westminster-based analysis is the Mancunian voters being told, yeah, all right, you might have voted for him to be your mayor 2 years ago, but, you know, little pat on the head. The grown-ups are in the room now, and we're changing that. And that's yeah. quite contemptuous.
Yes, I think it is. I think it's using them as pawns. It's forgetting the power of the voters, and the voters are clever things, you know. They're clever beings. Well, they will work it out, and they will decide what they want to do, and they will get their own back if they ever want to.
And then a quick word, if you would, on Alan, on the relatively wet ammunition, and by that I just mean damp ammunition given to the right wing media, most of whom have moved on from this story, but the Daily Mail's front page. Burnham rebellion growing. That is something that Starmer and his team factor in as an affordable cost.
Yes, they have to. I wish that those that in the Labour Party who want to get rid of Starmer listen to your introduction today and take the utilitarian approach to it, because now isn't the time to get rid of Starmer. If they do want to do it, if they're going to be clever, they'd do it 6, 8, 10, 12 months ahead of a general election, because that will give Labour the best chance of then going to the people and asking the people to endorse what the politicians have done behind the scenes.
A fresh offer. Thank you for that, Alan. It is 10:31. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I don't know. I'm getting a problem of observing these things partly through the lens of lobby correspondents who mostly work for newspapers and that are desperately and eternally dedicated to opposing anything that's not Tory or even further right than Tory. You kind of don't know about the scale of the problem. But 50 people signing a letter complaining about it is 50 people signing a letter complaining about it. It's not like 1922 committee letters of dissatisfaction. It's not up there with a sort of constant aura of threat that hung around Boris Johnson's final months or Liz Truss's entire premiership. So I, again, it's my job, isn't it, to cut through that and try and provide you with clearer analysis, but I can't. I can't without you. All I can tell you is that they seem quite desperate to get rid of Starmer. And if you think back to his predecessor, I never met a Tory. I never met a Tory who wanted Jeremy Corbyn to be replaced as leader of the Labour Party, even after he did much better than was expected in that election called by Theresa May, because Labour somehow, despite being led by a Leaver, became the last repository for hopes that Brexit might be reversed. I never met a Tory that wanted Jeremy Corbyn to be replaced. So the fact that the Tories really want Starmer to be replaced, the Tory press really want him to be replaced, might be significant, it might not, because whoever replaces him, they'll probably move on to character assassination of them as well. Corbyn, something of an exception in that rule. 10:32 is the time. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
The Home Secretary has defended the use of a former military barracks in East Sussex to house asylum seekers. Up to 500 men could be placed at Crowborough training camp. Shabana Mahmood has told LBC that she understands local concerns, but the move is part of efforts to close asylum hotels. Separately, the Home Secretary says the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing for Parliament was finely balanced. Around 50 Labour MPs have urged the Prime Minister to reconsider the move by the party's governing body. Flooding from Storm Chandra has led to major travel disruption. Several roads in the southwest of England have been closed and rail services affected. And ground rents for leaseholders in England and Wales will be capped at £250 as part of government reforms aimed at giving homeowners greater control over their properties. LBC weather. Storm Chandra will bring heavy rain and strong winds through the morning, severe coastal gales in parts of the west, a high of 11 degrees.
This is LBC.
If you want all the best stories to tell, Best at Travel will provide the inspiration. For 40 years, our UK-based travel experts have been creating tailor-made luxury holidays. We are real people, passionate about making luxury travel personal, helping create your perfect trip. Secure your 2026 holiday today in the Best at Travel New Year sale. You can speak to one of our experts or book online at bestattravel.co.uk. Rated excellent on Trustpilot. Atoll protected.
I'm Leah, and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right, so my GP referred me to the CDC. Had some blood tests done, and within 24 hours I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
It might be cold outside, but things are really warming up at the Wren Winter Sale. With red-hot prices on our high-quality, fully-built kitchens and fitted bedrooms. Right now, there's up to 60% off fully-built kitchens and all bedroom units. Plus up to 7 years interest-free credit. Made for making you feel warm inside, whatever the weather. Wren. Made for living. Visit your nearest Wren showroom. Offers apply when you buy 5 or more kitchen units or 3 or more bedroom units. Finance subject to status and minimum spend.
As a business owner, you're full of potential, and so is your business. But to grow, to get somewhere new, you've got to try something new. So look around you. There's no better time than now to invest in a bright young T-level student. They'll inject fresh ideas and perspectives into your business, no matter its size. So go on, try something new.
It all starts with skills. Search Skills for Life.
What's the secret to feeling young? Cryo chambers? Vampire facials? Forest bathing? Really? The real secret to feeling young can be found in the new Seat Ibiza and new Arona. Both have smart new looks and stylish new interiors. Plus, new alloy wheels and a 6-speaker sound system. Seat. Rolling young.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
10:36. Mark in Lim made this point before I just shared with you my analysis of how the right wing are currently reacting to Keir Starmer. So I give him the credit. I hadn't seen this. But it came in at 10:20, so I should have done. There is one alarm bell ringing for me, he writes. Or maybe I had read it and I hadn't actually clocked it. I just subconsciously absorbed by a process of intellectual osmosis the point being made. All the Tories reform are trying to get rid of Starmer. So Mr. and Mrs. Wrong from Wrongsville are suggesting that Starmer should resign or be replaced. Just think about that for a minute. Yeah, I mean, you're right, but one of my favourite commentators from the left, Polly Toynbee, is also suggesting that that Keir Starmer's days are numbered, Mark. And I don't think, well, you could describe her as Mrs. Wrong from Wrongsville if you want, but you certainly can't describe her as Tory or reform adjacent. 10:37 is the time. And well, we're reading out messages that I should have read out earlier. This from Stu. I'm a big, big fan. That's a good way to start a message. I'm a big, big fan, but. That works, like, I love you, but. So that's if you want to get something negative read out. Just preface it with the words, I love you, but, or I'm a big, big fan, but. Only James could say, let's jump right into the calls after doing a 20-minute monologue. Well, you say that, Stu. I think I could make a case for arguing that that was quite an early point at which to get into the calls, so my original suggestion stands. Carl is in Liverpool, which is, of course, Andy Burnham's home turf, but no longer politically. Carl, what would you like to say?
I think this is the only possible outcome that we could have seen, James. Yeah. I think Starmer is thinking not only for his own kind of political survival, but more importantly for the stability of the government. And I think if Burnham had got in, it would have just opened the floodgates, not only for loads of speculation and another campaign, election campaign around the mayoralty, but then also for every single twist and turn, every ups and every all the downs and the pitfalls that Starmer would be seeing for the rest of his term. Mm. There would be that sniping. There would be the media speculation of, is Burnham going to go and try and unseat him? And I think there would be a temptation. Well, I think Burnham, by actually the way that he's applied to do this as well, he sought permission from the NEC instead of going to Starmer first. I think Burnham's, like, you know, laid his cards out there and made it clear that if he does go in, he's possibly is going in to basically try and unseat Starmer.
And that's probably a little bit of what's the word I want? Not petulance. What's the word for, like, being a little bit previous? Oh, previous will do. It's probably a little bit previous of Andy Burnham to have become so entirely associated with a leadership challenge.
I think so, but then, I mean, and yeah, and I think you see that in his response as well, that whether he gave out about, you know, the response that the NEC had made not to block him. But I think the other thing to say is there needs to come a point, but I don't think it's now, when Starmer thinks what is best for the country. Now, presuming he thinks Labour is best for the country,
yes,
he needs to look at who is best for Labour, and the polling are saying it isn't him and it is Burnham. So, you know, are you getting to some sort of thing where they make a deal or whatever? But I think to bring in Burnham at this stage would have just been too problematic for the rest of Keir Starmer's term.
And that's presuming he wins. Because, of course, if he loses the by-election...
Exactly. That's the other thing. You mentioned that at the top, didn't you? The internal polling is saying that they might not even win it, which is another good reason for Starmer not to have allowed him to go through with it.
I've tried to write down the various permutations that could happen. But it's probably going to be as successful yesterday as my attempt to describe the difference between a rock and a hard place and ending up having to introduce a cliff face and a brick wall because there were so many different paths that things could go down. But you've got lose-lose, which is Burnham runs for Parliament and frees up the mayoralty and they lose both of the resulting elections. You've got lose-keep, which is now on the table, which is that they lose the by-election but Burnham doesn't fight it, so they keep the mayoralty. And then you've got win-keep, which is Burnham doesn't run. Whoever does run, Jonathan Ashworth or an other, they somehow win a by-election against all the odds. And, of course, they hang on to the mayoralty. Or you've got win-win, which would involve Burnham running, winning,
and then another
candidate running for mayor and winning as well. And I think most people would probably put that fourth option in fourth place in terms of likelihood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think... And like I say, I think the problem with that is as well, there's so much risk in it, but then there's the noise around it and you're going to have all of the media kind of, you know, unpicking the different results of it. I just think it's too messy and it's the expense of it as well.
I don't know that gets taken into many individual voters' calculus, but I'll tell you what you've done, Carl, and all the callers today have done. It answered the question I was asking earlier. It's a little bit stupid of me, really, not to realise. How do you cut through the fact that almost all of the coverage, certainly the print coverage in this country, has to be viewed through the lens of a hideously biased media ownership? You know, the owner of the Daily Mail, the owner of the Times, the owner of the Sun. In fact, they're all edited now by former protégés or apprentices to Paul Dacre. The maddest man in Madsville, currently a little bit preoccupied, of course, at the High Court. But the nature of print media in this country is so utterly bent that you can sit here wondering how you cut through it when the answer's staring us in the face. You just set the facts out correctly and open up your phone lines. So far, quite good listening for Keir Starmer. Albeit that there aren't exactly any cheerleaders on the line. In terms of pragmatism and utilitarianism, he kind of had to do this. And although I'm not part of this, there is a sort of sense in my inbox of people who still think he can turn the oil tanker around. Adam is in Haverhill. What would you like to say, Adam?
Hi, James.
Hello.
I agree with your previous callers. I think Keir Starmer made exactly the right decision. If the whole thing was a kind of lose-lose, really, for Starmer. But yeah.
He
took the win that was there, you know, and I think he was absolutely the right decision to make.
Simply because of all the calculations that we've been running through. Of all the options that could happen, but when you combine likelihood and desirability, there's a trade-off, isn't there, between likelihood and desirability. You don't put all your money on what you want to happen. You split your bet according to what is likely to happen. And this way, the worst-case scenario is that they lose a by-election and hang on to the mayoralty, which closes down the worst-case scenario, which is they lose a by-election and lose the mayoralty.
Absolutely.
What about the cowardice angle? I'm going to quote Polly Toynbee, who I am a big fan of. She's one of my favourite writers and indeed one of my favourite thinkers. Declaring war on Andy Burnham anoints him as a northern martyr and hero and casts Keir Starmer as a coward.
I don't agree with that.
No, I don't think I do anymore. I did at 10 o'clock. This is what happens. This is what happens when you listen to other people. No wonder so few people do it.
Exactly. We should never listen to anyone.
You should never listen to anybody. Pick your opinions and stick to them. And if you don't like them, I've got others. Because,
exactly.
Because of the way that we've broken it down, and also because of the character that Starmer seems to be, cowardice probably wouldn't come into the calculations.
No, I think Starmer is completely pragmatic. My concerns are that the advice he gets from his current chief of staff is taking him down routes that yes. maybe the government should not be going down. But as to Starmer himself, you know, I've heard him described as a non-idealist in the sense that, you know, he's someone that will look at a problem and try to solve it, rather than coming to it with any ideological baggage. And, you know, that's something I completely subscribe to. But, I mean, I think sometimes people do bang on about Labour comms. And I do think it's not really worked so far, and they just need to find, an answer to that particularly sort of knotty equation. So that they can actually communicate properly, or not properly, but more effectively with the people of the country. So that they do try, but to a certain extent, but the problem is that overwhelmingly the media are acting as the official opposition, as Tom Baldwin put it.
Yeah, but they always will. I mean, it doesn't matter who's in charge of late. Tony Blair somehow managed to walk that tightrope but you know, he ended up godfather to one of Rupert Murdoch's children, so there are some.
Jesus, did he really?
Yes, he really did. I'm beginning to think you haven't read my last book, Adam, but there are some paths that you wouldn't necessarily want any politician to go down, let alone an ostensibly left-wing one. It is 10:45. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. A quick one from Tom, actually, because this is quite thoughtful as well. Manchester resident for over 20 years, married to a Mancunian, kids are Mancunian. Doesn't that make you a Mancunian, Tom? We don't want to go all Suella Braverman, who, of course, doesn't think she or her kids can be English, despite being English. Only Sir Keir is actually thinking about Manchester. Manchester has been left out of this conversation. Andy Burnham does now need to go, but in a managed transition for an equally experienced and competent Labour candidate. For example, Rayner or Reynolds, I think you mean Starmer at that point, Nandy, Powell, etc. Manchester cannot be left in the lurch just because we're economically successful and a few MPs want a leadership change in London. Manchester has been left out of the conversation. That is the point I was trying to make earlier when I said I think we're under pricing because a lot of coverage is coming out of Westminster. What you'd feel like as a Labour voter in Manchester who got the mayor you wanted, who described it as the dream job, the job of his life, the only job he'd ever wanted. 10:46 is the time.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
Unless you do a course which is vocational and necessary for you to go into a particular area, like maybe teaching or law, and you do it at a very good university, I've got to be honest, I don't know what the case for going to university is anymore. You are saddled with such massive debts that has turned into a tax that is completely regressive because the richest are able to avoid that tax because they can just pay the fees up front. That's not fair.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Hi Derek, Tara from Flash Designs here, hope you're well. Not sure if you've seen my emails from last month, but could you please pay my invoice? Thank you so much. Bye. Hi, it's Tara, Flash Designs. Did you get my last voicemail? I know you're busy, but please pay my invoice today, if possible. Hello, again, it's Tara, again, politely nudging, again.
Still chasing unpaid invoices? Let Sage Copilot help do the chasing so you can get paid up to 7 days faster. Search Sage Accountant today.
It's not easy being a clamp stuck on the wheel of the one person on the street who didn't tax their car. Yeah, Graham at number 7, I'm talking about you. Bet the neighbourhood group chat is as well. Wish I had a group chat. Maybe I can chat to myself.
Hi, Clampy. How's it going?
Not great, Clampy. Being clamped to the only untaxed car for miles is so lonely.
Over 98% of drivers tax their vehicle on time. Tax it. Don't risk it. Visit gov.uk/DVLA/taxit.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry. Just had even more of my team are off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for business. Fee reviewed periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
You want £1 million.
I'd love £1 million.
So you enter the birthday draw. It's a very personal draw. So you think of a personal way to spend £1 million.
I would hire a hype man so everything I do would suddenly be epic.
It's a lucky day and you win the birthday draw. So
let's go cab goat cheese bagel for lunch.
Is it your lucky day? For your chance to win £1 million, just search the birthday draw and enter now. From Global and ITV. 18 plus UK only. No purchase necessary.
Imagine your dream holiday made possible by comparing cheap flights on Kayak, walking on an unspoilt goes on for miles beach on the Sardinian coast, plunging into the splendor of an idyllic lagoon in Greece. Ah, yes, this is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare prices from hundreds of travel sites and airlines to find your dream deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
James O'Brien on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
It is 10 minutes to 11 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. You'll be aware already, certainly if you've had your radio on, that today is Holocaust Memorial Day. You may not be aware that there is a theme to this year's commemoration, which you can also see as a call to action. It's called Bridging Generations, and it recognises the challenge of keeping remembrance alive after survivors have passed on, children, grandchildren, and of course all of us. So I do want you to, if you've got something to do, come back at 11:45 when I'll be joined by one of the authors of a book that recounts a truly extraordinary story. The only known story of Holocaust survivors walking away from a gas chamber. I don't want to tell you much more about it because it has such sort of narrative impact. I want you to hear it fresh, as it were, from one of the author's mouths, but I will tell you that 800 boys aged 13 to 17 years were taken out of Block 11 at Auschwitz on an October day in 1944. And the story of how 51 of them survived has been told in a brand new book, actually, published just last week, last Thursday, called Miracle. And we will meet with Naftali Schiff, one of the authors of this book, in about an hour's time. So I just want to give you a quick heads up for that. We'll also be commemorating Holocaust Memorial Day on LBC throughout all of our programming today. 10:51 is the time. Back to the question of Keir Starmer and Andy Burnham, the good people of Manchester, the mayoralty, the by-election, stability, utilitarianism and the future. Just off the top of my head. Joe's in Colchester. Joe, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. How are you? All right?
Very well, mate. What's on your mind?
Good, good. Yeah, I just want to say I think Starmer's made the worst decision he could make. It is a very much a catch-22 situation for him. There's no good outcome from Burnham applying, but to block him was the wrong decision in the interests of both democracy, the Labour Party, and his own interests.
Go on, tell me more.
Okay, so well, first of all,
let's start with democracy. He just got elected as mayor of Manchester, and the people that voted for him will be told, "Sorry, doesn't matter what you voted for 2 years ago. You're going to have to choose another one now." So, I mean, there's an argument both against and in favour of democracy being undermined. So, yeah, no voters
it's up to the
yet.
Local constituents. Yeah, but it's up to the local constituents to decide on its candidate. So, if the local constituency decide they want Andy Burnham is the candidate, there will be another mayoral election which will give people the chance to demonstrate there.
Again, the Labour Party constitution.
Demonstrate
the
vote.
The Labour Party constitution states that they need to be approved by the NEC. It's not like they've invented a rule to keep Burnham out.
No.
And that was a vote.
I don't believe in that constitution. And so did Starmer said a few years ago he didn't believe that the NEC should be blocking candidates and that they should be decided by the local party, by the local constituency.
And that hurts him now.
That's who should decide the candidate.
Okay. I quite like this. I'm struck that this is the political equivalent of football. Because you're in Essex. With a passionate support for a Mancunian mayor.
Yeah.
I thought you hadn't got the joke.
Yeah.
And you're a big Burnham fan, I think.
I think, yeah, yes, I am.
Okay.
100%, yeah. I think Mandy Burnham would make a great Prime Minister. My hope that when Keir Starmer came in is that this would happen. I supported Starmer from the beginning until he rolled back on everything that he promised the members. And on the run-up to the election about a year before, you could see that he was not the candidate that was going to bring about change in this country. But, you know, that aside, I think for Starmer's own interests and for the interests of the Labour Party, he's made an absolute blunder of a decision. If he was to elect Burnham run, it's been noted that Burnham might not win. So let's have a look at that situation. If Burnham didn't win, his problems are over. There's no leadership contest coming. Burnham's finished. Okay.
Yeah, but it's a disaster for the Labour Party, though. It's an appalling party. I mean, I'm glad you've rung in, because I think it's important that these points get aired, and some of them might actually undo some of the points that have been aired previously. But that would be a disaster. They arguably could have neither the mayoralty nor the constituency. And Keir Starmer's job is to manage the Labour Party as well as to run the government. And that no manager on the planet would claim that losing the league and the cup was actually the right thing to have deliberately put yourself in a position to do.
No, but who would take the flack if that was to happen?
Starmer.
Let's be realistic.
Starmer would.
I don't think he would.
He'd take it from the right-wing media. He'd take it from you, Joe, let's be honest, and he'd take it from all of the media as well. And he'd probably take it from the Parliamentary Labour Party.
Letting Burnham stand, I think that Burnham would be the one that would come out, his leadership challenge would be over. Yeah, look, if they lost the mayoral and the thing and he immediately accepted Burnham in without any hesitation, maybe there would be some spin on it, some spin on him, some bad press on him, but I think that Burnham would come out worse off if he was to lose that
election. Everybody loses.
The likelihood, in from my opinion, is Burnham will win that hands down. If he doesn't run, they will lose it.
Okay. That's a win for you. That's a win for you, because that's never going to be tested. So that's you can have that. No one can ever take that away from you. You can be certain that Burnham would have won. And you might be right, but you haven't persuaded me. We will agree to disagree on this in the calculations I've undertaken. I was closer to where you are now at 10 o'clock this morning than I am now, but the calculations you've undertaken do two things. I think they over-egg Burnham's electoral appeal, both in the constituency and in the broader country, and they undervalue some of the things that Starmer and his team have said. Most obviously this, resources, whether that's money or people, need to be focused on the elections that we must have, not elections that we don't have to have. And so, go on.
This by-election, we must have this by-election.
Yeah, but we don't need to have a mayoral election,
the best
mate.
Candidate. But we know
which is much bigger.
Going to be a challenge. Yeah, but we know the seat is going to be a challenge, and therefore we need the best candidate to run it. And let's be honest, the new mayoral candidate would be fully supported by Andy Burnham, would be somebody that would be designed to continue the project that Andy Burnham has started,
and abandoned,
I believe would have a very, very strong chance of retaining that seat with Burnham's full support. Burnham would give his absolute full support to that candidate, and would basically, that candidate would be running on the basis that they will continue everything that Burnham's already, the great work that Burnham's been doing in Manchester.
You're right. All of the counterfactuals are on your side, because someone else can ring in and say, "Don't be ridiculous. There's not a hope in hell." And you could say, "I'm confident that I'm right." And no one can ever prove it otherwise. But in terms of working out what is likely to happen, or what is possible, as opposed to what you wish for or what you think is probable, shutting down lose-lose for most people seems like a bigger priority than rolling the dice on the possibility of win-win. And what you've got instead is worst-case scenario, lose-keep, best-case scenario, win-keep. Under your analysis, you've got worst-case scenario, lose-lose. And that's off the table entirely. So that's the pragmatic course to take. If you remove the personalities from it, and don't allow yourself to be swayed by the question of whether you want Keir Starmer to be replaced, I don't see how you can overcome that utilitarian argument. You've taken lose-lose off the table. You've left win-win on it, but you've increased the likelihood of lose-win, or at least lose-keep. 10:59 is the time. Should I squeeze in Alan in Sheffield, or should we hit the news on time for once? Alan, I'll give you 1 minute. What would you like to say?
The reality is it was a very difficult decision, and I'm not sure he could have won whatever he did.
Well, there's no good outcome. It's all bad. No, it's gradations of badness.
But the reality is, I canvass on the ground in Sheffield quite a lot.
Right.
And Labour are very, very unpopular at the moment. Mm. And what would have happened, and if you look at the latest opinion polls for the Greater Manchester, Labour are down by 12 points in the morality. So what you'd have done, you've had an unnecessary election, you would have lost the by-election to Reform, you would have lost the morality to Reform, you then, in May, lose places like Birmingham, you lose places like Barnsley, and you're in for a disaster. And Starmer and the people down in London know that. And, it's a situation where they can do very little about, because there is an irrational hatred of Starmer on the doorstep in four working class areas, which has been built up from a whole variety of sources.
What are your favourite sources? What are your favourite sources? This Eleanor and I are fascinated by this. We talk about it quite a lot because it's visceral, this hatred.
Visceral.
And I can understand a visceral hatred of a politician whose law enforcement officers are shooting civilians in the face. I can understand a visceral hatred of a politician who lies through his teeth about leaving the European Union or being anti-Semitic in his school days or whatever that behaviour is. I can understand a visceral reaction to that. How do we account for a visceral reaction to what could be best described as a sort of excessive managerialism?
Well, I taught politics for 30 years at a university. Gosh. And I can't explain it.
No.
Because people, he's not the worst prime minister we've ever had. He's not the best. But the hatred comes from a place, which people like Reform are now.
Online sort of demonization. Yeah. We had that conversation yesterday about the racist accounts that are just utterly fraudulent. Keir Starmer's been on the receiving end of similar, but it doesn't necessarily, it also casts our fellow citizens in an appalling light, doesn't it, that they'd be so susceptible to that. But, you can say he's let us down, I've been quite unimpressed, but a visceral hatred of him as an individual is just weird. Thank you, Alan. So, a broad consensus, although not unanimous, that he had little choice but to follow the course that he has followed. I mean, there's quite a lot to talk about today, or none of which takes us back happily to US politics, although if anything happens there, I'll bring it to your attention immediately. Up next, I think I'm drawn to my all-time favourite subject. Do you know what that is?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Home Secretary has defended the use of a former military barracks to house asylum seekers despite months of protests. Up to 500 men could be placed at Crowborough training camp in East Sussex. The local authority is considering legal action against the plans. Shabana Mahmood's told LBC that she does understand concerns locally, but the sites are a better option than hotels.
I think it deals with one of the pull factors. We know that organised immigration criminals are advertising the fact that you get a hotel room when you arrive in Britain as one of the ways that they're luring people into the small boats in the first place. So I want to break that ability to advertise the hotel rooms. And that's why I think military sites where a much larger group of people are housed in much more basic accommodation, that is the right solution.
The Home Secretary has also told LBC the decision to block Andy Burnham from standing for Parliament was finally balanced. Around 50 Labour MPs have urged the Prime Minister to reconsider the move by the party's governing body. The Labour MP, John Pearce, has been appointed as the UK's special envoy for post-Holocaust issues. The government says the new role will promote education, remembrance and research. Events are taking place across the UK to mark Holocaust Memorial Day.
Storm Chandra is battering large parts of the UK, causing flooding and widespread travel disruption. Several roads have been closed and rail services affected in the southwest of England. At least 30 flights at Belfast City Airport have been cancelled. Forecaster Claire Nazir has told LBC snow could also cause issues.
The rain is heavy. It's pushing northwards, encountering the cold air. At elevation, above around 300 metres, we are seeing that rain turn to snow. And that's going to cause problems if people are trying to get from one place to another over those higher routes, so roads such as the M62, the M8, the A9.
New drivers in Northern Ireland will become the first in the UK to get graduated driver's licences from October. Rules include a 6-month minimum learning period and passenger restrictions for those who recently passed their tests. It's aimed at reducing the number of deaths on the roads involving young people. And ground rents will be capped at £250 a year in England and Wales as part of major housing reforms. New leasehold flats will be banned and existing leased holders will get the right to switch to common hold. LBC weather, Storm Chandra bringing heavy rain and strong winds which will push north and east with hill snow in the north, turning drier in the south later, a high of 11 degrees. And a short time ago in the city, the FTSE 100 was trading up 47 at £10,196 the pound. Buys $1.36 and €1.15. From Global's newsroom, the LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Dogs and cats, sure, they need a lot, but they're worth every penny. Still, would be good if you could save a few pennies, right? Well, if you've got a Tesco Club Card, you'll get a Club Card discount on Tesco Pet Insurance. And all policies include VetPhone for peace of mind 24/7. Just search online for Tesco Pet Insurance. Pets aged 8 weeks or over, vet phone provided by Vets Direct Limited. Monetary limits, excesses and exclusions apply. Arranged by Pinnacle Insurance Limited.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Just did it again, didn't we? Of course there's a topic there. I don't know why we've never done it, have we? Can anyone... you've got a better memory than I have these days. Have we ever done a deep dive into the visceral hatred of Keir Starmer? A couple of you pointing out that Sadiq Khan can suffer from similar expressions of hatred. But with Sadiq, you know, an awful lot of it at least has its roots in racism. What would the same be for Keir Starmer? We'll definitely get that up and running, possibly even before the end of this week. But it's not so... Eleanor, who produces this programme, I nearly said allegedly, but that would sound like I was criticising her instead of criticising the programme. So I could say Eleanor, who produces this alleged programme, has a favourite subject. She's fascinated by diet, obesity in general, particularly among children. And one of my all-time favourite subjects is not poetry about potholes, as one self-appointed wit just suggested on WhatsApp. Is class. I find class and the relationship that our country has with class abidingly fascinating. And I actually don't believe that we're ever going to have anything close to equality, never mind the sort of social mobility that we took for granted in my childhood, without addressing some of the great issues and problems that class creates. Even that story that is the definition of Labour's current problem, in that it's a great story and it's a great policy, but it's not, for want of a better word, sexy. About leaseholders and ground rents. You know, why does England and Wales have a system under which people can pay huge sums of money for the privilege of living in their own home? And the answer is feudalism. The answer is that it actually goes back to medieval times. And that is a direct consequence of having serfdom and a hierarchy of humanity that had people at the top with everything and people at the bottom with absolutely nothing. And if the people near the bottom had something, then the people at the top wanted a piece of the action, wanted a slice. Most of the leaseholds I come across, and I look in estate agent windows in central London, are owned by members of the aristocracy or the royal family. I don't know yet how that will be affected by Labour's new policies. But Graham points out that I'm not being entirely honest with you when I suggest that class is my favourite subject, because my favourite subject is obviously myself. You raise a valid point, Graham, actually, but not one that I'm going to explore any further today, because these are the headlines that break my heart. A quarter of GPs are seeing obese children aged 4 or younger. Almost a quarter of GPs are seeing children aged 4 or younger who are obese. About half of GPs have seen boys and girls up to the age of 7 who have obesity. A handful are younger than a year old. And doctors find it very difficult to talk to children or their parents about the condition. I think this is an absolutely fascinating subject because there is a generational shift that I thought was an unalloyed positive in the context of what we have recently come to call fat shaming. So I'm 54 years old, would you believe, last week. I know, I don't look it. It's all the tinted moisturiser, probably. I look at my school days, and I remember, for good or for ill, but this was far from extraordinary or unique, I remember the lads, because I was mostly at all-boys schools, from the age of seven, I was at all-boys schools. I look at the lads who were probably obese, although I don't think it was a word that we used much at the time. If I'd been overweight, probably would have been my nickname, actually, because of my initials, because of the OB at the beginning of my name. But I can remember them. I've told you this before. So I would say that the lads in my class and the class above, and probably the year below as well, out of, say, 20 kids, there would be one or two that were notably large, and their nicknames would reflect their largeness. I would once have argued affectionately, but, of course, I'd have to ask them that, wouldn't I? What I say is that when we used those nicknames, one of which, actually three of which I can remember, were bestowed by a maths teacher, by the same maths teacher, who also doubled up as a PE teacher, and it was at PE that their obesity would be pointed out and reflected in the, quotes, funny stroke clever, end quotes, nicknames that the maths teacher came up with for them. I can remember the nicknames to this day, and I can remember the actual names of the lads concerned. And we didn't think anything of it. We certainly didn't think it was cruel or unkind. But we didn't acknowledge or really think about any health implications either. Now you come to today when, if I were to comment on your weight in any way, shape or form, or your child's weight, you would think that I had taken leave of my senses. Possibly you can still compliment people on being slim. We still live in a tyranny of slimness in our country, in our society. But if I were to say to you, God, you've put on a bit of weight, or you can tell people they've lost weight, can't you? Can't you? You can tell, because, I mean, it's happened a lot with the jabs and the Ozempic lately. You can say to people, gosh, you've lost weight, you look well. But you can't, in the context of children, you can't fat shame. Which is absolutely as it should be. But obesity is a major health problem. And the idea of an obese baby, a child under the age of one being obese, should be setting off alarm bells in every single corner of the family. And indeed the doctor's surgery. I don't want, and I'm doing this a lot at the moment, and I'm not 100% sure I'm going to carry on doing it, telling you what I don't want you to do in the context of a phone-in, but I don't want to have a conversation about the unreliability of body mass index as a gauge for obesity, because everybody's already heard it before, and for the avoidance of that, we're talking about children who are obese, children who are sufficiently overweight to endanger their health, okay? I know that England prop forwards have body mass indexes that relate to obesity despite not having an ounce of fat on them. But that's not the point of this phone-in. So, you know, spare us. You remember the characters in children's fiction. You remember the characters in Grange Hill who were notable for their size and singled out because of it, who were ridiculed in some senses or at least recognised as a consequence of their size. So I understand, I think, why doctors have got such a problem on their hands. That was the bit of the story that grabbed my attention. I mean, the headline is immediately arresting, but the idea that doctors find it difficult to talk to children or their parents about the condition. And I don't know what the question is here, apart from how do you talk to children or their parents about obese children? I suspect that grandparents do more harm than good if they start weighing in and laying down the law or commenting upon the size of their grandchildren as a way of perhaps criticising their mother in some contexts. I don't know how you do it. But you have to do it. So you go around to Grandma's and she's got a big bucket of sweets on the sitting room table, and simultaneously she's tutting and whoring with H-A-W-I-N-G at Mum as a way of sort of having a swing at her daughter-in-law for fattening up the children. Boys probably get a much easier ride than girls, do they, still, in our society? So an obese boy is probably going to be complimented for the healthiness of his appetite, whereas an obese little girl is going to be fat-shamed. I don't know. As I say, I was only at school with boys from the age of about 7 onwards. And as Alyssa points out, you shouldn't say that you look well to somebody who has lost weight, because you're implying that they looked awful when they were bigger. And it could also have been unintentional weight loss as an illness. So you're probably better off not commenting on anybody else's weight ever. In which case, how do you deal with obesity? Oh, that is actually a brilliant question. So I quite like the idea of living in a world where nobody ever comments on anybody else's weight. And I speak as someone who went through a shameful period in presenting this programme, where I routinely and very enthusiastically ridiculed obese people. I don't know why it's such a popular trope for lazy, performative media figures, which I was, to attack people who are obese and to just roll out that ludicrous claim that all you have to do is eat less and exercise more, as if it were easy. Somebody said to me in the middle of that period of my life, imagine that you encountered somebody with bulimia or anorexia and you shouted down your radio microphone that they should just eat more and exercise less. How big an idiot would you be? How vicious and cruel and unpleasant would you be? Answer, very. So why on earth was it okay for years to just shout eat less and exercise more at people who were obese? Not all of whom would have an eating disorder in medical context, but the crassness of it is as huge as the popularity of it still, although happily not quite as popular as much as it used to be, because at least we've stopped. But given that we want to live in a world where none of us ever comment on anybody's weight ever, especially children, Alyssa's point notwithstanding, if you went on a massive diet and lost loads of weight, you'd probably want your mates to point it out, wouldn't you? How do you do that? Should we do that as well? So we're all now seeing the benefits, or at least the effects, of fat jabs. We're all seeing friends and colleagues who have lost decent and significant amounts of weight. My gut reaction is to compliment them. If you've gone on a course of medication to lose weight, then obviously you wanted to lose weight. And if it has succeeded, you have been successful. Therefore, my gut reaction would be to compliment you. That's okay, right? There's so much wiggle room here. So you probably don't want to live in a world where we never comment on anybody else's weight ever. Because then you wouldn't get complimented when you've, especially if you've actually dieted and you've tried really hard and you've changed your mental wiring and succeeded in all sorts of areas where you didn't previously think you would succeed, you'd quite like a pat on the back, right? I nearly said a biscuit then, which would have been unhelpful in the circumstances. You'd quite like a pat on the back. You'd quite like a well done. So we don't necessarily want to live in a world where nobody ever mentions anybody else's weight ever. But if we're talking about children, so how on earth do you do it? How do you address, question number one, why do we have still, given all the public health work that is being done, why do we still have such a heartbreaking problem with childhood obesity? 0345 6060 973. Question number two, how on earth do you do this? We understand so much more about eating disorders now and the outwardly sometimes quite small triggers that can prompt huge responses. You have to be so careful in not feeding obsession or obsessive behavior. You have a child with an obesity problem, and you recognize that it is a problem that we should be trying to solve, and we have absolutely no idea how to do so. And we can't feel bad about it, because 4 out of 5 family doctors find it difficult to talk to children or their parents about the children's obesity. I suppose if there are any GPs listening, you can tell me why. Why is it so hard, given that it didn't used to be? Presumably for reasons that we would largely regard as positive. Question number two, or at least point number two, that 4 out of 5 family doctors find it difficult to talk to children or their parents about the condition. I would cautiously suggest that the 1 out of 5 GPs who've told researchers they find it easy to talk to children or their parents about obesity. Some of them may be doing massive harm. You can imagine the kind of GP that I'm talking about, can't you? You just turn around and say, and you're too fat. To a child who then carries that scar, I think, for an incredibly long time. If you were an obese child, have you got any idea what would help? Or what would have helped you? That maybe is one way. So GPs, front of the queue. People who were obese children, front of the queue. What would have helped you? And how on earth do you address this issue? Whether you're a doctor, a parent, a grandparent, a friend. I don't think a friend. I honestly... Talked about obesity a million times on this program. Talked about diet, talked about health, talked about Mounjaro and Ozempic and all the rest of it. But I don't know that I've ever asked you how on earth you talk to an obese child about their weight and health. Or even the parents of an obese child. How does a parent talk to a child about obesity without making everything worse? How do you address the physical without damaging the mental? I'm going to cautiously suggest to you at 19 minutes after 11 that you can't. You can't. You cannot bring a child's attention to their own obesity without doing that child mental harm. And what do we, if that's right, what the hell do we do with that discovery? So I've said quite a lot of words, all roughly about the same subject. I've asked you some questions, not like razor-sharp questions, not laser-focused questions, but you now know as much about this topic as I do, and you share my confusion about how we've ended up in this situation. And you also now, with me, wrestle with this question of whether or not it's actually true that you can never address a child's obesity with that child, or indeed with their parents. The one in five GPs who think it's easy are probably making everything worse. That's the question. How on earth do you do it? 0345 6060973. And how do you undo it? How do you undo this obesity that is a problem? Because these kids will more than likely grow up to be obese and therefore become not living their best lives in many ways. That's a sad thing. I come at this from any angle you want. Phone lines are open. The number you need, as always, is 0345 6060973.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling,
don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, and the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
A Thames Link train is a place where you can have more me time. A chance to skip traffic and glide to wherever you need to be. With headspace to focus on more important matters. Like if that cloud is a starfish or sunflower. Fast journeys without the rush with great deals at ThamesLinkRailway.com. Terms apply.
It's time to scale up that fishmonger business, and with free day-to-day online banking from Virgin Money, you'll be a big fish in no time. Now that's a real catch of the day. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus fees apply for chaps and international payments. Terms and exclusions apply. Backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name. Applies to your bank PLC.
I'm Leah and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right. So my GP referred me to the CDC. Had some blood tests done and within 24 hours I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS fit for the future. Available England wide.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
22 minutes after 11. I think we'll stop doing this job when we can't find anything new to say or we don't feel that there are any new angles to conversations that we've had on a regular basis. And I've never confronted before or even contemplated the fact that doctors feel they can't talk to children or their parents about children's obesity. And that is, I mean, I don't want to say fascinating because I'm making light of the difficulties and the problems that this highlights, but it's something that we need to talk about. Rachel is in Worcester. Rachel, what would you like to say?
Hi.
Hello.
So I'm just going to give you a quick overview of myself and then sort of explain to you about my son. So my mum was a bit of a hippie and she exclusively breastfed me. I was born in 1980 and she was told to diet me because I was a fat baby, even though I was exclusively breastfed. And my mum was absolutely horrified. How do you diet a baby that's exclusively breastfed?
I'm not being silly, but don't you just breastfeed them less?
You could do, but then the baby would be really hungry and screaming.
I'm being an idiot. Carry on.
So that happened. I was then a fat child, had to have clothes made, went to Weight Watchers at 10. I've been up and down with my weight all my life. I've always known what I am.
Yeah.
And then my doctor did tackle me over it and said, look, I think you need to go for a bypass because, you know, this is not a one-off.
A gastric bypass.
Yeah, a gastric bypass, which I had in April, and it has been life-changing, right. And it's been amazing.
Good.
But what I have discovered, because I was referred to the Tier 3 weight management, is that obesity isn't about just what you consume and what you exercise. It's actually much more complex. And if you go through the dietitians in the NHS, obesity is recognised as a chronic disease.
Yes, I know.
And the thing is...
That's why I drew the parallel with anorexia, actually, because it's so... No one would ever say to an anorexic person, why don't you just eat more and exercise less?
Yeah, I know.
And yet everyone shouts at people like you that you should just eat less and exercise more.
Yeah, and do you know what? I've done that all my life.
Of course you have.
You know, all my life, and I know what I am. And my grandmother also suffered with weight, and my son, who's 12 now, suffers with his weight. And he says to me, I just wish I was like my friend's mummy. I eat half of what they do, and I'm big. And I know he is, and he knows what to do. I'm well educated on food, particularly after going through the Tier 3 Weight Management Service program.
Yes.
And, you know, it isn't just about what you put in and what you do exercise-wise. There is so much more complexity to it. And it's not even that you're necessarily overeating that's made you overweight. It can be gut bacteria. They told me that it's massively under-researched, the cause of obesity, because everybody's just thought it's this simple, how many calories you eat,
and
how many calories...
Well, every family knows this, because every family will be feeding their children the same things and watching very different bodies emerge.
We need to have a big overhaul and research into obesity on the causes of it, and also explain to parents, you know, we don't mean it's your fault. What we mean is we just want to check you're well educated.
Well, how do you do it with your boy? How do you have that? Because you told me what he said. You didn't tell me what you said in response.
To which bit?
When he's unhappy about his own size.
I said to him, I am so sorry, my darling. I said, I am exactly the same. I said, you've seen me. I've been a size 24 and now I'm a size 14. He knows that I've suffered because I'm open about it.
Yeah.
And I say to him, it is just really hard. I said to him, obviously, being a man, men often find it slightly easier to shift weight because they've got heavier muscle mass, so their output of calories is generally more than women. So I'm hoping that perhaps when he grows tall, I mean, he's 12, he hasn't quite hit puberty yet, but it will help. My uncle was the same, actually, and he did shoot up and did slim down, so I'm kind of waiting for that. Otherwise, I'm going to be saying to him, don't wait until you're in your 40s to have a bypass. You know, try and get it earlier because it is life-changing, but... Having bariatric surgery is robbing Peter to pay Paul. So you do, you know, I will be in a state of malnutrition now for life, and I will have to have B12 injections every 3 months for life. I have to have CalCD. I have to have iron pills. I have to take loads of other vitamins and things. So I'm not, you know, walking around health-free, and I also wouldn't recommend going and having any of this type of surgery privately because the NHS, some... will take you on, but there's so much after work, I wouldn't recommend it. But ultimately, it's about the way that a person is approached to answer your question. How do you tackle it? My doctor, my husband, said he was such a brave man and still laughs about it now.
Well, what did he do? We can't really give advice on medical
projects.
No, I'm just, hang on, I need to say this. We can't, I mean, neither of us should really be giving advice on medical matters because neither of us are qualified. You need to obviously speak to your doctor, speak to the NHS and follow whatever advice you're given. What did your doctor do that your husband thought was brave?
He said to me, you are overweight, which you haven't always been. And he said, is there something going on? And I said, actually, I've always suffered with my weight. I've just always tried to diet, but it's, I've realised now, I was 37 at the time when I decided to jack in dieting, and I said, it messes with my mental health because you lose all that weight, it's really hard work, and then it always goes back on. I said, I can't do that to me or my body anymore. I need to accept what I am. And I said, I have accepted it, and I'm actually happy with my size. And he said to me, but you will die young if you don't do it.
Now, so this Jeep, would he be able to do the same thing if he was talking about a child, do you think? You say to it, because he sounds like one of the 1 in 5 GPs that doesn't really struggle with delivering these messages.
Such a good bedside manner. He was so kind
and lucky, so nice.
And he was happy to listen. And I said to him, I don't really want to go for a bypass. And he said to me, no. He said, just see what it's like.
And again, I think obviously the conversation that we're having today would fall short of bariatric surgery for most of the people that we're thinking about, and certainly in the context of how you deal with, and I'm delighted that things have worked out so well for you, Rachel, but in the context of how you deal with obese children, certainly as you've suggested in the context of your son, it might be something that is further down the road when they grow up, but in the question of how you help now, I don't think bariatrics, I don't think you're suggesting it, but I certainly don't think anybody would suggest that bariatric surgery would be a solution to childhood obesity. So what is the solution, not even to the obesity, but to having the conversation? Why, and this is something that we can all have a think about, not just people with personal experience of the issues, why would a doctor have a problem telling the parents that the child is obese? It puts me in mind of the generational shift in how parents respond to teachers telling them that their child has been naughty. It's a great cartoon. I've mentioned it to you a few times. I can never fully remember it, and every time I mention it, you send me it. There's a great cartoon about what happened in the 1970s at a parents' night when the teacher says, and little Keith is being very naughty. And what would happen now? So in the 70s, the kid would get into trouble. In the noughties, the argument is that the teacher would get into trouble. So the parent, mum and dad sit down on parents' evening and the teacher says, I'm afraid we've got some terrible problems with Keith's behaviour. And it's like, well, wait till I get you home, Keith. We're going to sort. And now you'd sit down and the teacher would have had some terrible problems with Keith's behaviour. And how dare you? How dare you criticise Keith? That possibly is the doctor's equivalent, in that once no one would have thought twice about saying your child is obese, we're going to have to do something about it. Why would doctors now be troubled or find it difficult to tell a parent that their child is obese? I want you to answer that question. There's a couple of phone lines free, and there's the one that Rachel's vacating now as well, so you know the number. Dominic Ellis has the headlines.
The Home Secretary has defended the use of a former military barracks to house asylum seekers despite months of protests. Shabana Mahmood has told LBC that the site in Crowborough in East Sussex is more cost-effective than using asylum hotels. Storm Chandra has brought flooding, travel disruption and school closures to the UK. As heavy rain and strong winds take hold in Devon, firefighters have been dealing with several cars which have been stuck in floodwater. And the government's announced ground rents for leaseholders in England and Wales will be capped at £250 a year. A trade body representing professional freeholders say the move is wholly unjustified. LBC weather, as mentioned, Storm Chandra bringing heavy rain and strong winds, severe coastal gales in parts of the west, a high of 11 degrees.
This is LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like. From Real Octopus Energy Calls.
Your customer service was tip-top. You know, I couldn't fault it.
The customer service was really good.
The people are friendly on the telephone. You can always get a problem solved.
Octopus are an absolute breath of fresh air.
People like yourself and all of your colleagues have done such a wonderful job.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running.
Everything you know and love starts with water. Your dog, your car, your internet. And then there is just the small miracle of keeping us alive. Without drinking water, you wouldn't survive more than 3 days. So let's raise a glass to clean water. It's hard to imagine life without it. Seriously, how is it that 1 million people die every year because they lack access to clean water? That's not just unthinkable. That's wrong. Donate to WaterAid today. Just £2 a month can give life-changing clean water.
Get your home entertainment sorted with deals on EE's award-winning bundles.
Why is it award-winning?
Because you can flex between your subscriptions like Netflix, Discovery, Now, and TNT.
Sofa sessions?
Sorted.
Oh, yeah. Plus, it's powered by ultra-fast full-fiber 150 on the UK's best broadband technology with absolutely nothing to pay up front.
Nothing?
Nice.
Offer ends 29th of January.
New customer, 62% UK availability. Terms apply.
When an offender is released, the probation service keeps them on track so they can find a place to live, which gives them the stability to say no to old habits, making them more likely to attend their supervision meetings. And all of that ripples out to make the community a better place to live. Search probation service jobs to find out more. An extraordinary job done by someone like you.
At Pets in a Pickle, we know what it's like welcoming a new pet into the family. They're cute, they're chaos, and sometimes they get themselves into a pickle. That's why we offer fuss-free pet insurance policies with unlimited video call access with First Vet. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60 973.
It is 26 minutes to 12 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where childhood obesity, you'd think given the amount of time that's dedicated to discussing it, it would have been solved by now. Because it feels more solvable than some of the things that we spend an awful lot of time discussing. And yet here we are, looking at a country in which a dizzying number of doctors are encountering obese children, and in which 4 out of 5 GPs tell us that they don't know how to raise the subject, or they're not comfortable raising the subject with either the child, which is probably fair enough, or the parent. Here's a question for you. Hayley and Tracy up next, but here's a question we could get to. When you were small, but also obese, did anybody get it right? Did anybody actually draw attention to the need for you to lose weight in a way that, looking back, you think was helpful and healthy? Because I can't for the life of me imagine what it was. Because even if they do it via your parents are going to have to bite the bullet, aren't they? Your parents are going to have to institute the changes. So when you look back, at your childhood obesity and the attempts made by outsiders, doctors, or insiders, parents, to address it, what worked? Because I can't, at 25 to 12, I can't come up with a thing that would work. What actually worked? And Rachel in Worcester a moment ago, absolutely right to remind us that this is a huge and complicated subject, and the eat less, exercise more mantra is about as helpful as a chocolate teapot. So what actually worked when you look back? I can't say that, can I? Because it's your life, not mine. But that old, the other mantra I hate is, you've got to be cruel to be kind. What damage is done? I don't know. I'll shut up and listen to you. Hayley's on the Isle of Dogs. Hayley, what would you like to say?
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thanks. What's on your mind?
Quickly, my father died of complications from being morbidly obese during COVID. I'm almost 50 and was obese as a child. Nobody told me to do anything about it. Obviously, I was aware of it. When I was 13, I took myself to Weight Watchers.
Good Lord.
And ended up becoming anorexic and struggled with anorexia throughout my teens. Only sort of got better whilst I was at university.
Right.
Moving on quite a few years, my daughter, who was overweight, but I wouldn't really call her obese, became anorexic during COVID. And she spent a few years in and out of, you know, mental health hospitals. Thankfully, she's now almost 18 and she's doing amazing and better. But one experience which I really vividly remember is going to the doctor with her when we knew she was anorexic, because right. I could see the pattern.
Yes.
And the doctor looked at her and said, you just need to eat a bit more.
Oh.
I'm like, okay. So that was then.
Oh, boy.
2 years.
So that's one of the doctors that doesn't think that they are uncomfortable talking to people, talking to children about. That's the point I was trying to make about, because so 4 out of 5 say they're uncomfortable, and I worry about the 1 in 5 who think they're comfortable, because they're probably saying things like that.
Exactly. So, and also what I would like to say is, you must never put a child on a diet. If anorexia is very complicated and there's a genetic link, various other things, but it's very, very complicated. Obviously, the parents need to be educated in adjusting the diet. But if you put a child on a diet like me, it's very easy to get to a weight where it switches over to anorexia, which is a lot more harmful.
So how do you do it? How would you do it?
I don't know. That's the answer, is I don't know. But
good,
all I know is from my experience, it was bad, and it was only down to us as parents that got our daughter better, because I knew what the signs were in the history.
And so we can make a long list of how not to do it, and whatever we're left with at the end might possibly point us towards to how to do it, because at the moment that's an empty piece of paper. Don't put them on a diet. Don't tell them to eat less. I mean, the opposite equivalent of what your daughter was told. And don't even draw attention to it. I can't imagine there are any overweight people in the world who don't know they're overweight. What age do you think you become conscious of it?
Mine was probably in primary school.
Right.
I went to a very nice school, didn't really get teased, but it was being aware that children were wearing different clothes and I had to wear elasticated waists and things like that. That's when I became aware. But very quickly, I think I lost 3 stone in about 8 months.
Wow.
At the age of 13, and then, you know, struggled with being very underweight for quite a number of years.
Of course. Of course, and I mean, I suppose in some ways the battle is never over. I mean, you're always conscious of it, and it's only ever under control. It's never completely banished. Is that right?
There are elements of that. I mean, you can recover completely from anorexia, but it's a very complicated illness and involves gaining weight beyond a certain amount. So, you know, that society thinks that thin is, you know, good. Yeah. It's good to be thin, but some people aren't designed to be thin. And unless you get someone up to a weight that's healthy for them, they're never going to be fully mentally recovered.
I mean, I'm so grateful to you for everything you've said, but also for using those three such crucial words that you hardly ever hear in public discourse anymore. I don't know. I hear them quite a lot on this program, probably, but that's probably a mark of weakness on my part. But I don't know. So what do you do? I don't know. And that's why, 4 out of 5 doctors are uncomfortable having this conversation with children or their parents. And B, I was actually more worried about the 1 in 5 who weren't uncomfortable addressing such sensitive issues, because the chances are they're going to be coming out with something as crass and unhelpful as what Hayley's daughter heard in the GP surgery, coming at it from, if you like, the opposite end of the problem, through being anorexic rather than having obesity issues as a consequence of other types of eating disorders or disorders. 11:40 is the time. How the hell would we do it? How have we got to 2026 in a country where we talk about childhood obesity all the time without actually knowing how you talk about childhood obesity to the people who are affected? Don't put them on a diet. Do you weigh them? Do you encourage them to be healthier without mentioning weight? There's some interesting viral clips on TikTok, or whatever it is. What do I get on my Facebook? Is it Reels? So I'm not really on TikTok. I obviously LBC is on TikTok, and I'm on TikTok, but I'm not on TikTok, if you see what I mean. One day I'll tell you who I met, and the first thing that they said to me was, oh, I love your clips on TikTok. I'll tell you one day. Am I allowed to ever tell you who that was? I don't think I am. Actually, you will not believe me. If you come to the gig with Gary Lineker next month and you get me after the show and you want a special insight, and to the most unlikely person on the planet to say to somebody, oh, I love your clips on TikTok, then I shall tell you one-on-one. I'll do it for 2 people and 2 people only, given that you'll have already made a fairly hefty donation to Global's Make Some Noise. But how have we ended up in a place where we don't know how to have a conversation about something that we have a conversation about all the time? Tracy's in Radlett. Tracy, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi there, James.
Hello, Tracy.
Okay, so many things. Oh, my goodness. Right, so I do a workshop for parents to try and help them with this issue. And you're right, there are no easy answers, are there? I think there was one...
I think there was one place in Amsterdam that actually managed to reduce obesity in children. And it was such a multifaceted thing that they did. They did so many different things, mostly education, very strict in schools, encouraged cultural cooking and all kinds of things like that. But going back to your doctors, I think part of the problem is they're not that knowledgeable about these kind of things.
Yeah.
They don't have the time. They don't want to upset the parents. And as you said, BMI is not a very good measure, and it is a very tricky subject to bring in. So what I suggest is you make your waist half your height. It's like an easy one to work out. Because it's okay. The fat around the tummy that is the problem. These are all the health risks. It's not actually your weight. And what your previous callers have pointed out is everyone's got a set point. So we're not all designed to be the same weight. And yet social media can already make people, children as young as 5, already worried about their weight. Well, they were never going to be what you're supposed to be.
Is there a typical child who comes to your classes? Is that, do you do them for children?
What I do is I go into schools, because I actually think...
So you're addressing everybody. You're addressing the whole class. They haven't just... Good Lord, I don't know quite how I'd phrase this, but they haven't just filtered the children so that the ones with the issue come into... Because that would be as bad as...
No, not at all.
No.
And I'm doing one on eating disorders as well.
Right.
Because as you said, what's so tricky for parents is if they try and push the child in one direction, are they going to trigger an eating disorder? Exactly what your last caller was saying. So you do have to be incredibly sensitive, and I don't think doctors are actually geared for that.
Well, clearly not, but maybe teachers. I mean, this is from Susan. Your talk around childhood obesity. My grandson's school had a weigh-in recently, and children were told in front of the class whether they were an acceptable weight or overweight or obese.
That makes my blood boil. We used to do it very discreetly.
Yeah.
And as I said, I've got so many issues with BMI as
no,
it is.
I understand that. And you also understand that I've closed down that avenue of conversation at the outset of this. Because I mean, it's pertinent, but it's not necessary. It's not the if you pardon the pun, it's not the meat and drink of what we're actually talking about this hour. So nobody, except people who are categorically and completely wrong, nobody, and of course, this being the country that we live in at the moment, incredibly confident in their wrongness. Nobody knows how to address this, really. If you've got a parent in front of you with an obese child and you need to draw attention to the child's obesity, your best answer, and it's probably the best we're going to get, is an equation comparing waist to height, but that is just a euphemism for obese.
We have to understand that these ultra-processed foods, they bypass that feeling of fullness. So, and they are addicted. So if we as parents are eating them, and then our children are eating them, they're very hard to say no to. So what we have to try and do is encourage more of the healthy good things. And that's
a public health issue. That's something that we just do for
Absolutely.
Everybody. And we don't single
Absolutely.
Out, we don't single out the people with the quotes problem end quotes. A, because it's not got anything to do with them necessarily behaving differently from the people who haven't got the quotes problem end quotes. And B, there is a huge benefit to the whole of society from, cutting out ultra processed foods or massively reducing the amount of ultra processed foods that we consume, or hugely increasing the amount of education we have about the dangers of ultra-processed foods, which, as with so many of the problems that this country faces, takes us back to Tufton Street and all the secretly funded lobby groups masquerading as think tanks that are dedicated to promoting and protecting the interests of the people and the businesses that make huge amounts of money out of making our children obese and unhealthy. And us, of course, and adults. But apparently, it's free speech or something if you start demanding that they tell you who funds them. In fact, if I were to tell you who was in court recently trying to prevent you and I from knowing who actually funds their operation, you wouldn't believe me. What would be the most ironic and ridiculous organisation that pops up in the UK media with the same sort of unerring regularity that you see all sorts of shysters and charlatans claiming to be lobby groups, or I beg your pardon, claiming to be think tanks when they are in fact lobby groups? And I said to you, well, you know, what would be the single most ridiculous organisation that was desperate to prevent you from finding out who funded them? What organisation would you say? Remind me to tell you before I go home. It is 11:47.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
It's Call the Cabinet exclusively here on LBC with the Home Secretary, Jemana Mahmood, who is in the studio with me. Sue is in Crowborough. Sue, you're on the radio. Your question to the Home Secretary.
It's your policy to continue to move illegal immigrant men into sites like the Crowborough Cadet Training Camp. How will you keep the residents of Crowborough safe?
We are working closely with the police. We're working closely with the local authority.
And you've had a conversation with the Chief Constable. You expect increased policing of some form in Crowborough?
I haven't spoken to the Chief Constable directly myself. I will do. The Policing Minister and the Immigration Minister are all talking to the local authorities.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Across the country, thousands of drivers are feeling electric about switching to an EV. And here's why. They can go from London to Sheffield on a single charge that could cost around a fiver. They're ecstatic about that and the exhilarating feeling behind the wheel. Plus, with charging made simple at home, they're always ready for the drive ahead. I can see why they're into it. Switch to an EV and get that electric feeling. Cost and range dependent on tariffs, model and driving habits. For full details, visit gov.uk/clean energy.
To be or not to be.
Right now, we're offering a range of incentives across Audi models.
That is the...
But only until the 28th of February.
The,
So stop whatever you're doing.
I'll be right back. Just carry on without me.
And find yours online or at your local Audi centre. Audi. Vorsprung durch Technik. Terms and conditions apply. Selected models, retail customers and participating Audi centres only.
During the Air France Rendezvous, take advantage of great offers. Until the 27th of January, book your flight to Dubai from £399 or Hong Kong from £589, from London Heathrow via Paris, return including tax. And from the 29th of March, you can reach Paris and beyond with our new flights from London Gatwick. Elegance is a journey. Air France. To book and for terms and conditions, visit airfrance.co.uk.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. Holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
I'm Leah, and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right, and my GP referred me to CDC. Had some blood tests done, and within 24 hours, I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
James O'Brien on LBC.
It is 10 minutes to 12, and you're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I was flicking through the TV channels last night, and I stumbled onto One Life, which you may have seen, in which Anthony Hopkins plays Nicholas Winton. If you don't automatically recognise the name, you'll recognise the story. Nicholas Winton was the man who masterminded and orchestrated the escape from the Nazis of about 6,000 children, I think, in total. And when I was a kid, they did it on TV. Maybe not quite a kid, but they did it on That's Life, a programme that was presented by Esther Ranson, and ambushed him in the studio with the adults that the children he'd helped rescue had become. And it struck me that the power of a story, a really incredible story, reaches parts that textbooks and even historians cannot reach, appropriately, because, as you know, today is Holocaust Memorial Day. I'm going to draw your attention next to a truly extraordinary story, and it's one that I was not previously aware of. Rabbi Naftali Schiff is a globally renowned collator of the testimonies of Holocaust survivors and a documentary filmmaker, and has written, along with Michael Calvin, Miracle, The Boys Who Escaped the Gas Chamber in Auschwitz. And Naftali joins me now. Was this story known, or is it something that you unearthed in your researches, Naftali?
Good morning, James.
It's a story that was known amongst people had heard of it. Historians had heard of it, but Nobody had actually interviewed a number of these saved teenagers.
51 in total at the time. Tell us exactly what happened to them, if you would.
Well, on the day of Simchat Torah, which is the same English date as October the 7th, 1944, a few hundred Hungarian teenage boys were rounded up and taken to the gas chambers and ordered to undress, and literally were ordered into the gas chamber, and the door was closed. And at the last moment, there was a commotion, and there was a selection, as there was quite often in Auschwitz, who will live, who will die, by the infamous Dr. Mengele, the SS commandant of the camp. And 50 boys actually were chosen, and another boy managed to sort of escape out of the gas chambers with them. They were told to get dressed, and they were sent back to the barracks. And over the course of the last 20 years, I had the privilege of meeting 6 of them. And all of them had incredibly lucid memories. It was a remarkable story, remarkable people.
Because after they were removed to, I think, unload a consignment of potatoes, if I've understood the story correctly, that had just arrived from Greece, that the timing was such that they never faced that peril again? How come it wasn't just a temporary reprieve rather than a permanent freedom?
Right, that's a good. But the answer is that the war was nearing the end,
yeah.
And quite soon after that, they stopped using the gas chambers. And today, actually, Holocaust Memorial Day, January the 27th, is just 10 days after the beginning of what became known as the infamous Death March from Auschwitz,
yes.
Which began on the 17th of January. And these boys, those who survived, were after that reprieve, they were then forced to march, in some cases, hundreds of miles back to Germany in pyjamas, freezing cold.
Will you forgive me if this is a stupid question? But of the 6 survivors who you've spent a lot of time with, what did they most have in common as a consequence of this shared experience? Is there anything that typifies their future lives that you would trace back in all 6 cases to this moment?
Stubborn will to live. Stubborn, strong people with a will of steel and a positive, optimistic view on life. And I'll add, you know, I've interviewed tens of people who were on this death march that took place the 10 days before January the 27th, and I've asked them, how did you keep going?
Mm.
And all of them remarkably gave the same answer, one step at a time, which I think is a very important message. It's not about winning, it's just about keep going. And I think this is one of the remarkable legacies of these survivors, something that our younger generation would do well to learn, that it's not about instant victory. It's about consistency and really believing and hoping and working to build a better world. And I would say the other thing that they all had in common is that's exactly what they did. They weren't people who lived lives of vengeance.
Mm.
They were people who lived lives of joy and building, rebuilding, helping, contributing to society in a remarkable way.
I mean, that's wonderful to hear. And again, I'd sort of hesitate to ask this question, but I think that I should. Survivor's guilt is a well-established psychological phenomenon, isn't it? Were they young enough to be unaffected by it, or is it something that some of them have wrestled with in the later years?
You know, within the Jewish community, yes. People do refer to a survivor's guilt. They refer to Hitler, even the people who survived. There's second generation, there's third generation trauma. But this cadre of people, and it could be because they were the toughest, because any survivor with an adult memory today is well into their 90s. On the contrary, they were people driven by love of life, a thirst to really enjoy life and teach goodness to their children, their grandchildren. These six alone, between them, have something like 1,000 descendants. I was actually the wedding of a grandchild of one of them, who's still alive, and he was the happiest guy in the room.
I think you've answered my final question, probably, which is about the point you raise about the age of the survivors. The theme of Holocaust Memorial Day today, as you know, Naftali, is bridging generations. It's a recognition, isn't it, of the fact that it's going to be children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren that carry on these stories through the generations.
Hopefully all of us will carry on these stories. And I would say, and the reason why I have done this is because I think this is a universal point. You know, there are all sorts of tragedies, terrible things going on in the world, and there have been, you know, terrible, man's inhumanity to man. And I think the Holocaust is just maybe the defining symbol of man's inhumanity to man. And in a world of more and more virtual reality and AI and fake news, I think the authenticity of survivors is really their most powerful feature. And that's something that we somehow need to bring to our younger generation, that they know the difference between goodness and evil, between selfishness and selflessness, between giving and just taking, and looking into the eyes of these survivors through the words of the book Miracle, which one can get on Amazon.
I was going to do that bit, Naftali, don't worry.
You can do it too. So we've actually also made a documentary which really embellishes it more. And I really think authenticity is the thing that sums up these survivors for me.
Indeed it is. And as Naftali mentioned, Miracle is out now, published last week. The Boys Who Escaped the Gas Chamber in Auschwitz, published by Bantam. And you can find out more about the documentary film online. Rabbi Naftali Schiff, many thanks to you on what, as we just established, is Holocaust Memorial Day, and a Memorial Day with a theme of bridging generations, which actually makes me think, you won't, if you're a regular listener to the programme, be surprised to learn, it makes me think of my friend Lily Pullman, who, introduced me to her story, which was every bit as extraordinary as some of the better-known accounts of surviving the Holocaust, and which I think we shall probably return to for a moment or two in the next hour of the programme. But the time now is just approaching 12 noon. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, the Home Secretary has defended the use of a former military barracks to house asylum seekers despite months of protests. A council in East Sussex is contemplating legal action after the first group of adult males moved into Crowborough training camp last week. Eventually, up to 500 men will be temporarily housed there. Shabana Mahmood has told LBC that she understands the strength of feeling locally, who are concerned.
I have made sure that we are very alive as the Home Office, and also working with local partners about all of the potential ramifications for people, and that those measures are in place. So what I can reassure you is that we are working closely with everybody in the local area to make sure that those concerns are dealt with.
Separately, the Home Secretary has rejected claims the so-called one-in, one-out returns agreement with France is failing. Submerged, 350 people have arrived into the UK since the deal was agreed last August, while 281 migrants have been returned to Calais. Shabana Mahmood has told LBC that the pilot is being ramped up, adding that returns will grow. Firefighters in Devon and Somerset have rescued people from at least 25 vehicles in flood water. Heavy rain and strong winds from Storm Chandra have led to road and rail closures across the southwest this morning. A number of flights have been cancelled at Belfast City Airport. Tom Morgan is from the Met Office and has told LBC the unsettled weather is set to continue.
We've already had well over a month's worth of rainfall in the first kind of 3 weeks or so of January. It won't take very much in the way of rain to see some responses and also some flooding. And, of course, we've got further rain on the way throughout the rest of this week.
National landmarks will be lit up in purple later to mark Holocaust Memorial Day. The King and Queen will also hold a reception for survivors and their families. Ground rents will be capped at £250 a year in England and Wales. It's part of major changes to the leasehold system announced by the government earlier. New leasehold flats will be banned and people who currently live in them will get the right to switch to common hold. And Northern Ireland will become the first part of the UK to bring in additional rules for new drivers. Plans include restrictions on night-time driving and passenger numbers. They're aimed at reducing road accidents involving young people. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 57 at 10,206. The pound buys $1.37 and €1.15. LBC weather, Storm Chandra bringing heavy rain and strong winds which will push north and east, some hill snow in the north and turning drier in the south later in the afternoon, a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
You've arrived, your dream holiday. You got there for less thanks to comparing flight prices on Kayak. An idyllic local restaurant nestled in the cliffs. A peaceful pool with your own private sunbed. This is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare flight prices from hundreds of travel sites and bag a great deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It is 3 minutes after 12 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where, I mean, you can almost tell what category you fall into, depending on how you pronounce the word I'm about to say. I have always said class. I went to a school which possibly is the only place in the Catholic Church that says mass instead of mass, like for going to church. That's how posh my school. I know, absolutely ridiculous. Mass. I've told you the story of the tast, haven't I, at my prep school. Remember, my mum's from Sheffield and my dad's from Leeds, so when they sent me to these schools, they were introducing me to a world that they hadn't inhabited themselves. I didn't fully understand that at the time, but I understand it now. A headmaster's wife invited my dad to have a sort of coffee after he dropped me off one day, and he's sitting in the kitchen, and she says, "Would you like some tast?" And my dad, being a very good journalist who often found himself in unfamiliar situations, had no idea what she was talking about, but had a tactic for coping with situations in which he had no idea with whatever the person was talking about. I don't know if you ever do. If you go to someone's house and they say, "Would you have a drink? What would you like to drink?" And you don't know what to say. So you say, "Oh, I'll have whatever you're having." So dad just said, "Oh, I'll have some if you are." And then she gave him a slice of toast. That's how this person pronounced toast. Tast. Would you like some tast? That's not really relevant to what we're talking about, but it is, I suppose, pertinent to the question of whether you say class or class, let alone bath or bath or class or class. But these aren't necessarily class points, are they? They can be geographical. Although one thing I did notice about posh people is that they're posh wherever they grew up. With a possible exception of Edinburgh gentry, who have a sort of Edinburgh poshness. But even Welsh posh people sound like English posh. They all sound posh. Posh people who grew up in Carnarvon sound like posh people who grew up in Surrey. Posh people's accents are somehow geography proof. I don't know why. But I do know this. Talented white working class pupils lose ground at secondary school compared with black and Asian peers. This is important. Disadvantaged white pupils fall furthest behind as they progress through secondary school. So that means that the poorer the background, the worse the performance at GCSE and A level. And it kicks in even more when it comes to applying to selective universities. Disadvantaged Asian pupils and disadvantaged black girls often surpassed their white peers, getting substantially higher GCSE and A level grades. Asian and black pupils from poorer backgrounds were 40 to 60% more likely than disadvantaged white boys to progress to Russell's Group institution. You know how my mind works, don't you? There's part of me that wonders whether this is helpful. But I know where that comes from. I know where that comes from. When I started in this job, I think the statistics were the other way around. And I think that it was demonstrable via the research that black kids, particularly black boys, did worse in school than everybody else. And I'm not going to mention any names, but there would be radio phone-ins dedicated to explaining how it was all the parents' fault. and it was to do with the prevalence of single motherhood among the black community in Britain. And people would use words like baby mama or baby mother to explain why black children were doing worse than other children in British schools was a consequence not of anything going on in the schools, but of everything going on at home. And I remember thinking at the time that that's racist, isn't it? I mean, it is not as a consequence of their blackness that they're doing worse in school. It's a consequence of different treatments, some of which might be at home, but most of which is going to be institutional. And then in the ensuing 20 years, we've heard about how black kids were treated in school in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and we've made enormous progress. I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest to you that none of the people who were adamant 20 or 30 years ago that black boys did badly in school because their parents were irresponsible or absent or feckless are going to suggest today that white working class boys are doing badly in school because their parents are absent or work shy or feckless. But it doesn't necessarily follow that the argument is the same for both categories. I think aspiration is going to be relevant here. I know that, I mean, if not all of my black friends will tell me that when they were being brought up, they were always told they had to be twice as good as everybody else because of the discrimination and the racism that they would face. But the injection of aspiration. Now, Carla is brilliant on this. If you've not read his book, Natives, I really can't recommend it highly enough. Aspiration is injected from both without and within. It happens in a family, but all of the instruction to aspire that a family can inculcate in a child disappears if the school isn't joining in. So what you have here is schools that encourage people to aspire, now more or less equally. We've got rid of institutional racism in schools. And you're left with this horrible problem of white working class children being the ones least likely to thrive in school. And if the answer to that question is not aspiration at home, then I don't know what it is. Because there's nothing happening in classrooms that would constitute discrimination based upon skin colour, otherwise middle class white children would be suffering similarly. So what is the difference between the middle-class white family and the working-class white family when it comes to schooling? Answer, I think, the importance placed on education. What is the difference between the working-class white family and the working-class Asian family? Answer, the importance placed on education. What is the difference between black girls who are performing similarly at the age of 11 to white girls from a disadvantaged background? They're both from disadvantaged backgrounds. That explains why the black girls will do better than the white girls. Answer, the emphasis being placed on education at home. There's no other answer to this question. And it's a very uncomfortable conclusion to arrive at, but the more you think about it, the more obvious it is. Because the difference is about the difference between the middle-class white family and the working-class white family, and the emphasis that those families place on education. Do you know who I really get cross with at moments like this? It's the commentators and the column. Oh, that reminds me. Is there a Dick Littlejohn column in the Daily Mail today? I can't wait to see what he's had to say about the fascism on the streets of America being presided over by his hero, Donald Trump, and all the people in his administration lying through their teeth about the cold-blooded murder of Alex Pretty. I don't know. What day is it? Monday? I'll check. I hope there is, because it's great fun finding out what he has to say. But Tuesday, about his hero Donald Trump, who he would much rather have in power than any democratically elected British prime minister. So no doubt there's some fat slices of humble pie being eaten in the Daily Mail today after Donald Trump, his administration lied through their teeth about a man who dedicated his professional life to looking after military veterans. Oh, we'll have lots to say about that, I'm sure. We'll find out shortly. But the people I really hate in the context of this conversation are the people who turn working-class parents against teachers. Usually when they undertake industrial action, but also with all of the nonsense that we had in the 80s about political correctness and about... So you turn a teacher into an enemy. What do you think your child is learning? Yeah. That school doesn't matter, that school isn't important, that teachers are not their friends, that teachers are enemies. And it's insane how obvious some of this stuff is. So the 20 years I've been doing this job, the education institutions have addressed, and I'm sure they haven't got rid of it entirely, but they have addressed racism in schools to such a degree that there is no longer an innate racial disadvantage for black children. And that means that there's an equality of opportunity in schools, which means that the falling behind of white disadvantaged pupils is a direct consequence of what they are taking into school rather than what they are finding there. And what they are taking into school is a lack of reverence for education and a lack of respect for teachers. I hate this. I hate the fact that it's so obviously correct. I hate the fact that it is so inarguably and demonstrably true. But I love the fact that if you're a victim of what I've been describing, if you were persuaded by the racist rhetoric of 20 years ago about black boys doing badly in school, or if you are enjoying the resurgence of racism that's underway now, I love the fact that you can't pick a hole in this argument, because you know it's you that I'm talking about. You know that you don't give your children the best possible chance in life because you're too busy complaining about woke teachers or pride being celebrated in school or children being asked to come to school to celebrate multiculturalism by wearing the national dress of their parents' native country, and you turning up in a Union Jack top hat, your kid turning up in a Union Jack top hat and somehow claiming that they've been discriminated against when the teacher points out that that's not actually our national costume. They should have gone as a Morris dancer. So, what is it like to grow up in a home where the adults don't value education? This is a really important question. It doesn't matter what colour you are, what ethnicity you are, what background you are, or anything like that. But I, of all the things I have no clue about, and that I learn about from you, this is, well, it's two things. Number one, it's a bit like the conversation in the last hour, extraordinarily, given the amount of energy we've dedicated to these areas during our time together. I've never asked you this question before. I've never asked you this question before. And number two, I cannot be more ignorant about a subject than I am about this one. I mean, what is it like to grow up in a house with no books? What is it like to grow up in a house where mum and dad or dad or mum or your carers do not value education, do not pay any attention to how you're getting on at school, do not care about what you're doing at school? What is it like to grow up in a house that's even worse, where people are taking their attitudes towards the education system from social media or right-wing newspapers and encouraging their children to hold contempt for their teachers, to hold contempt for education? There's two areas. It ties in with the last hour where it boils my blood that they've managed to conflate middle class with the issue, as if it's somehow middle class to want your children to read books, or it's middle class to want your children to eat healthily, and it's working class to be obese and uneducated. It's such a dangerous, disgusting, damning and damaging practice and process, but it happens all around us. It happens all the time. You can think of examples of it now. But what is it like? I haven't got a clue what it would be like. Almost by definition, this is a question being asked to a self-selecting audience. So if you are listening to this program, and you grew up in a house like that, then you have somehow broken the spell of what you could almost call parental imposed ignorance. You've to some degree managed to discover for yourself the importance of education. Otherwise, you'd be watching GBeebies. You wouldn't be listening to LBC. And I want to know how you did that as well. So I cannot for a minute. And don't forget, this isn't just about class, because there were kids at my schools who were very, very posh and very, very rich, who never saw their parents, whose parents took absolutely zero interest in their education. I'm not kidding. I'm paying tens of thousands a year to send them to school, and there's a certain type of parent that thinks, well, that's it. That's my responsibility met. It's not my job to worry about what exam grades you get. If you don't get good A-levels, I'll sue them for all the money that I've spent on school. They existed, but the kids couldn't bring that into school because they were boarding schools, and the culture meant that that got left at the door. The teachers were in loco parentis in those moments. So it's not purely a class-based issue. But I have absolutely no idea. It's a bit like asking me what it would be like to grow up in a house where there was no love. I haven't got a clue what that would be like and what it would do to you. But to grow up in a house where education was not valued, what was that like? Now that you're old enough to look back and make comparisons with what you know the experiences of other people have. Do you know, of all the questions that pop up on Full Disclosure, the long-form interview podcast series that I do with various prominent people, famous people, of all the questions that pop up on that one, the one that pops up possibly the most is, were there a lot of books in your house when you were growing up? It just explains so much about horizons and expectations and aspirations. But I have absolutely no idea what it would be like to grow up in a house where education was not valued. So I need you to tell me. And this is the kind of question that I think falls very much into the category of, oh, I can't believe he's talking about me, but I never ring radio stations. There won't be that many people who can answer this, I don't think. Which means I really want you to. 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. What does it do to you to be growing up in a house where books or education are not valued, probably because of what is loosely described as class? Your parents persuaded that it doesn't matter, or that schools are woke, or that education is for the birds, or that it's a bit, I don't know, effeminate for boys to read books. I mean, what is it like to grow up in that kind of environment, and how did you get out of it? 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. Hit the numbers now; you will get through. I suppose we could look at the ethnic question as well, but I honestly don't think that it's that relevant, because if it had anything to do with ethnicity, then middle class white pupils would also be losing ground to middle class black and Asian pupils, and they're not. So the poverty of aspiration goes hand in hand with the poverty of means. And I have no idea what it would be like to grow up like that. It's 12:19.
This is LBC.
If you want all the best stories to tell, Best at Travel will provide the inspiration. For 40 years, our UK-based travel experts have been creating tailor-made luxury holidays. We are real people, passionate about making luxury travel personal, helping create your perfect trip. Secure your 2026 holiday today in the Best at Travel New Year sale. You can speak to one of our experts or book online at bestattravel.co.uk. Rated excellent on Trustpilot. Atoll protected.
Sounds like Arjun is going to wake up feeling fresh. And it's a good job, because he's got a big presentation to nail just down the road. Get better sleep for your money. Book your next workstay at Premier Inn.
That's it. We need a bigger car.
Smart speaker, what's an award-winning SUV?
The Tucson is an award-winning midsize SUV and is available for a 24-hour test drive.
They look great. And it's a self-charging hybrid too.
Smart speaker, search offers on a Hyundai Tucson.
The Tucson is available with 2 years 0% APR. And it's Hyundai, by the way.
Discover the Hyundai Tucson self-charging hybrid. Ends 31st of March, 25% deposit, finance subject to status. Hyundai UK is a credit broker, not a lender. Terms apply.
At Pets in a Pickle, we know what it's like welcoming a new pet into the family. They're cute, they're chaos, and sometimes they get themselves into a pickle. That's why we offer fuss-free pet insurance policies with unlimited video call access with First Vet. For pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Matilda. Why didn't I think of Matilda? That's basically, I just described the character in Roald Dahl's Matilda, didn't I? I just described it. In fact, Dr. Helen says, I wish I could get through. My nickname from my friends is Matilda. Clear a phone line for Dr. Helen. But that is, Matilda is the story of a little girl with an incredible brain, with epic intelligence, who grows up in a family. I don't know why, it's not fair on Roald Dahl, but it's a mark of what a brilliant performance it was from Danny DeVito. I've got Danny DeVito in my head now as the obnoxious father, the parents who are absolutely reveling in their own pig ignorance. What's it like to grow up in that kind of house? Albeit there won't be a sort of comical element to it as there is in Roald Dahl. Some breaking news for you. I'm not fully au fait with French politics insofar as knowing exactly what this means, but I can tell you that French MPs have just approved a bill banning social media for children under 15, which I think means that that it could be enforced at the start of the next school year. This whole idea gaining momentum across Europe, and it's something that we haven't talked about for at least a fortnight, so we'll probably return to this territory tomorrow. 130 votes to 21 to ban the use of mobile phones in high schools and ban social media. Do you know, it's just before I go to Tina in Bexhill, it took me a moment to understand why all those liars in Donald Trump's administration kept talking about free speech in this country. Oh, by the way, the organisation that went to court to stop you finding out who funds them, the one that would be the most ironic imaginable in that context, yeah, you're right, it was the Free Speech Union. I couldn't work out why they were telling so many lies about free speech in this country. Well, Elon Musk and J.D. Vance and the rest of them. J.D. Vance very much in the pocket of a billionaire called Peter Thiel or Peter Thiel. They're terrified of this kind of legislation because it's money. The richest men in the world are probably still the greediest men in the world. And decent legislation that limits children's access to social media will hit them where it hurts the most, in the already overstuffed pockets. So all of those lies, some of which, of course, are amplified and disseminated by UK politicians like Farage and Lady Ha-Ha, who's running for mayor in London, the truth of the matter is this is what they're most frightened of, actually having some meaningful legislation that limits the harm and the damage that they can do to our children, which has an enormous parallel with the conversation we had in the last hour about obesity. But in this hour, we're talking about education and a poverty of aspiration in the home, what that translates to in the classroom. Tina is in Bexhill. Tina, what would you like to say?
Hello. So, actually, just want to agree with you about what you just said about the social media. I think it's fantastic that it all needs to be banned. So, I grew up in a home. So, I grew up on a council estate. My mum didn't work. But ever since I left school, I have tried to educate myself as much as possible. I think because I would just want my children to know about the world and feel educated. Being at school, because my mum wasn't pushy, I think, I just couldn't be bothered when I was at school. I just thought, what's the point in this? What am I going to do with this? And I just left.
Well, how does a child arrive at the understanding of the importance of it if it's not being taught to them at home?
Yeah, I agree. Like, there wasn't anything at home that could like follow on from school or continue with education. I've got three children, and I'm not pushy, but I do.
There's nothing wrong with being a bit pushy.
But I like them to know about, you know, what's going on in the world and how all sorts of subjects.
When did it click, Tina? Can you remember? I don't imagine there was a single moment, but when did you sort of clock the fact that you'd been a little bit, I mean, they loved you, I hope, and I'm sure your mum and your dad, but
yeah,
you'd been
absolutely
a little bit let down on this front. When did you sort of clock?
Well, I tell you, I was pregnant at 17.
Right.
It's a cliche, I guess, but I had my daughter, and then when she was old enough that I could go to college, I just thought to myself, I don't want this to be a repeat. I want to, my generation, my next gender, the next generation, we can do better than this. And I want to know more, and I want my children to know more. And I guess the thought of not knowing any, you know, just being a bit ignorant, I think.
Knowledge is power.
I try to listen to programs like this as well, because I drive around from work, because I work as a support worker, so I'm like always in my car, and I'm constantly, I've got LBC on all the time, and I'm like, it's more education, constant.
Just absorbing stuff.
Yeah, I am like a sponge now.
There's no downside to it. How do you think, and I mean what I said about pushiness, you've heard the phrase that the squeaky wheel gets the most oil, so how do you How are you impressing upon your children the importance of education in a way that it wasn't impressed on you?
Well, my eldest daughter's just finished a degree in criminology and sociology.
Well yeah. done. That's great, isn't it?
Yeah. My middle child, she's like top of the class and everything. But I think some children are naturally born, like you said, Matilda. They're just like,
yes, of course.
Yeah. This is what my middle child's like. And my youngest, he struggles a bit more, but we sit down and I go through homework with him and we try and kind of solve it together.
Just there for them. You're there for all of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think that's it. It's just not. I don't like to use the word pushy, but I just. No. I generally think that just that bit of encouragement, because you do find subjects, tasks daunting, or you think you can't do something, and you can if you put your mind to it, you can do it. So it's just.
And that's it. And who knows where it comes from, that little moment of understanding that door. I love what you say about knowledge, though. I just want to know stuff. Crikey, I don't think that ever leaves you, actually. I just want to know stuff. I want to know more stuff. And the more you know, then possibly the more you understand. But even if you don't understand, the consolation of knowing can be very comforting as well. Tina, that's a perfect story. Thank you. I really appreciate you giving me a ring on that. 28 minutes after 10, this is from Wendy. We had no books at home. When I was about 7, I wandered into the local library and a kind member of staff signed me up. Later, I got into grammar school, and those two things enabled me to be the first member of my family to go to university, libraries. Something else that the Tories took away from many communities during austerity. In fact, that's where the Alexis Sale joke comes from, isn't it? The austerity being the political ideology that stems from the idea that the global financial crisis in 2008 was caused up by there being too many libraries in Wolverhampton. And I am from one of those houses, writes Owen, in Liverpool. My mum didn't really care about my education. She pushed my older brother and younger sister hard, but not me. They're now a head chef and a teacher, and I drive a van. I must have never been worth it. Owen, that's a terrible thing to write, and you obviously are worth it, and it, just because one person couldn't see your potential doesn't mean that other people wouldn't, and it certainly doesn't mean that there wasn't any. And leaving aside the fact that, goodness me, absolutely nothing wrong with driving a van, but you can't start feeling better about things like that until you start being a bit kinder to yourself. And what Owen's done there is give us an insight into the deep damage that taking away aspiration, particularly if you can compare yourself to other people who are being encouraged to have aspiration, the deep damage that taking away aspiration can do. It's coming up to 12:30. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
The Home Secretary has defended the use of a former military barracks to house asylum seekers despite months of protests. Shabana Mahmood's told LBC the use of the site in East Sussex is part of a mission to end the use of expensive hotels. Firefighters in Devon and Somerset have rescued people from at least 25 vehicles in flood water. Heavy rain and strong winds from Storm Chandra have led to road and rail closures across the southwest. And the government has announced ground rents for leaseholders in England and Wales will be capped at £250 a year. A trade body representing professional freeholders says the move is wholly unjustified. LBC weather, Storm Chandra bringing heavy rain and strong winds which will push north and east, hill snow in the north, turning drier in the south. Later, a high of 11 degrees.
LBC.
Caremark, passionately, professionally and cheerfully, delivers excellent home care. But it's so much more than that. Caremark is about improving life at home and keeping you for longer. From simple visits to more complex needs, Caremark has you covered. For a friendly chat, visit caremark.co.uk. There's no place quite like home. There's no care quite like Caremark.
At Signature, our award-winning care homes are where luxury, comfort and peace of mind come together. With locations across London and the Home Counties, we offer exceptional residential, nursing and dementia care within five-star surroundings that feature a wealth of amenities, including our new wellness studios. To find out how you can receive an exclusive £1,000 discount with our new inclusive pricing, book a visit now at signaturecarehomes.co.uk. Terms and conditions apply.
That's it. We need a bigger car.
Smart speaker, what's an award-winning SUV?
The Tucson is an award-winning midsize SUV and is available for a 24-hour test drive.
They look great. And it's a self-charging hybrid too.
Smart speaker, search offers on a Hyundai Tucson.
The Tucson is available with 2 years 0% APR. And it's Hyundai, by the way.
Discover the Hyundai Tucson self-charging hybrid. Ends 31st of March, 25% deposit, finance subject to status. Hyundai UK is a credit broker, not a lender. Terms apply.
That there is a great night's sleep. And when Susan wakes up, she's going to get to enjoy a delicious unlimited breakfast. Or, if that super comfy bed is just too hard to leave, Susan can enjoy a midday checkout. Get better sleep for your money. Book now at Premier Inn. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to dive into the crystal water of an ancient cave pool in Mexico. Or dry off in the sun on a white sand beach in the Maldives. Or pour yourself into the culture and chaos of a night market in Thailand. Seize the sale. Book in store and online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected travel dates apply. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com/terms.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
James, I was mocked by my parents for always having, quotes, my head in a book and told you can't learn everything from books. I was lucky because learning came naturally to me, writes Lee. I remember having to pay for my own travel to visit universities for interviews, and as I grew older, I realised my situation amongst my peers, my professional peers, was unique. That made me feel prouder of my achievements. I think it should do, Lee. But also, unwilling to share my success with my parents. Oh, that's a shame as well, isn't it? There's a lot going on here. William writes, it's Danny DeVito for me too, but don't discount Stephen Graham. He is as good as any actor out there, and he was in the proper British version. You're absolutely right, he was, and he was brilliant. But for me, because of the age I was when I saw it, probably Danny DeVito will always be Matilda's dad in celluloid fashion and form. 12:33 is the time. Sheila and Helen up next. I think it's Dr. Helen, actually, in Preston, who describes herself as Matilda. But before that, as promised, it is time to see what Dick Littlejohn has been writing about in the Daily Mail, because he must have turned his attention surely to the murder of Alex Pretty by, in fact, here is the first line of the column in the Daily Mail today. They told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears, wrote George Orwell in his dystopian novel 1984, about a world carved up into dictatorships. It was their final, most essential command. And the headline reads, in Trump's America, they murder nurses and poets to its everlasting shame. But unfortunately for Dick, that column is by Andrew Neil, who is somewhat belatedly rediscovering the brilliance that marked him out as one of the finest journalists of his generation before his brain got boiled by Brexit. And it's a brilliant piece. And it's something that every columnist, especially ones who have been cheerleading for Donald Trump through some of the worst excesses prior to the murder of Alex Pretty, should be turning their attention to. Which brings us to Dick Littlejohn and what he has to say about the cold-blooded murder of an ICU nurse who dedicated his life to looking after the military. Let's have a look. Oh. Starmer's no friend of the military. No wonder veterans are flocking to reform. It's a very strange way to respond to the murder by your political hero, Donald Trump, who you would rather have running Britain than the democratically elected British Prime Minister, presiding over a country where a nurse who looks after military veterans can be murdered in cold blood and then lied about by his most senior appointees. How can you not turn your attention to that? Well, let's have a look at that story. Better late than never, writes Dick Littlejohn in the Daily Mail. Donald Trump has recanted his offensive remarks about the contribution of British troops in Iran and Afghanistan. And then the headline, as we said, was Starmer's no friend of the military, no wonder veterans are flocking to reform. So let's just refresh our memories on what Sir Keir Starmer had to say about that disgusting denigration of British war dead at the end of last week.
I consider President Trump's remarks to be insulting and frankly appalling. And I'm not surprised they've caused such hurt to the loved ones of those who were killed or injured.
And let's remind ourselves what the Veterans Minister, Al Khan, had to say on X on the same day.
On Afghanistan, frankly, this is utterly ridiculous.
Many courageous and honourable service personnel from many nations fought on the front line. Many fought way beyond that.
Cammy Badenoch, leader of the Conservative Party.
This is complete nonsense. I spoke to parents of young men who had lost their lives in Afghanistan, and I think it is a disgrace to denigrate their memory like that. But I think that there is too much careless talk from President Trump. He clearly doesn't know the history of what happened.
And now the man that Dick Littlejohn considers to be the great champion of the British military, Nigel Farage.
It's not quite fair.
Oh, that's tough, isn't it? That's really tough. 12:37 is the time. It's extraordinary what an absence of education can do to a person, but when it's been inflicted upon their by their parents, it seems peculiarly unfair. What is it like to grow up in such circumstances? Sheila is in High Wycombe. Sheila, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. Nice
Hello.
To meet you.
Oh, we've met before, Sheila. You meet me every time you turn your radio on, but it's nice for me to meet you, you see.
Yeah, we've spoken before,
okay.
But not about this. And I don't often hear anyone speaking about this either. I grew up in a house with two siblings with no books and really poorly educated parents, which I think people who know me today may find surprising because I've done the complete opposite and so has my sister. My parents wouldn't have known anything that we were doing in school either. It was just non-existent. They were perhaps nothing beyond a primary education themselves. This isn't sort of a small rural Canada. But that's what they kind of expected for us as well. Wow. Like, it was not expected that we would go on to further education. It was just, you're going to get a job and kind of live kind of hand to mouth, I think, like most people in our community are. That's just your lot in life.
When did you realize that you didn't want that to be your lot in life?
Well, I had a really amazing teacher, and it always usually comes down to an amazing teacher. But yeah, I had a grade 6 teacher, Mr. McGraw, and he gave me my first book. I mean, he was a really passionate, educated man. He brought his own lectern into high school, which is insane, really, at the time. There's no teacher.
Did he come in on public transport?
Yeah, just a rural sort of Canadian school, but he insisted that was the vibe he was going for. And he gifted me my very first book, which I take with me everywhere I move. I obviously now live in Canada, or in England. So, when I tell everyone what the first book was, they're shocked. The very first book I was ever gifted by my teacher was The Brothers Karamazov.
Wow.
By Dostoevsky.
Yeah, I mean, you started at the deep end then.
Yeah, but he inspired me. He challenged me as well. He wasn't easy on me. And he said to me, you know, it's up to you if you want to go for this, if you want to actually show people that you're more than this. And honestly, years later, after I'd lived in England for so many years, I happened to run into him. And he was quite elderly and didn't live much longer after that. And I was so... I'm getting emotional talking about it. Yeah, I was so happy to... tell him that I had made it, that I had got out of there, and that I went on, and I'm currently finishing my degree now with 3 kids at home, but I never stopped believing that I could have that, even though I came from a poor household, that I could have that too.
And what you're reminding us of is that the power of education, even when it's not a passport to, you know, material things, it goes often hand in hand. You can reach stages in life that you couldn't reach without the education, but the education as an end in itself is so undervalued by so many people from all sorts of backgrounds, even people who encourage their children to get educated.
Yeah, and exactly. I saw my sister, my older sister as well, was a big inspiration. Like, she went to art school, and I remember that being really denigrated in sort of working class community as well, because not only were you going to further education, but it was the arts. Like, what the heck are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you going to do with that? And it kind of gave me, I think, more than just being a positive thing, I think I just became angry that I was given this lot in life and I was told I wasn't really allowed to get out of it.
It's not for the likes of you. It's not for the,
yeah.
It's the inner life that you're describing as well as the outer life, the richness, the increased richness of the inner life. that comes as a consequence of being introduced to things like Dostoevsky. It doesn't have to be Dostoevsky. It's just something that you wouldn't ordinarily stumble across in a house where books weren't valued and education was not seen as something that was powerful in and of its own, even of itself, not just as a way of accessing other professional positions or status levels. This from Susan is absolutely heartbreaking. But then it just puts such a massive smile on my face at the end, Susan. This is one of my favourite texts in a very long time. You also have a poet's way with words, if you don't mind me saying that. Get your head out of that book and do something useful, in quotes. I'm 77 and that still resonates. Meanwhile, my granddaughter's copy of Matilda has fallen apart and she always has three books on the go, one of which is read to her by her mum. That is what I think they call breaking the cycle. Isn't it? That's what Sheila was describing as well, breaking the cycle. Helen is in Preston. We found a line for you, Helen, whose friends call you Matilda. What? We know what made you pick up the phone. What would you like to say?
Well, when you were describing, I thought, oh my goodness me, that's me and that's Matilda. So I grew up in a very deprived working class background. My parents, left school when they were young. They didn't, not at all scholastic. My dad's a dustbin man and... I think from a very young age, kind of always felt a little bit different. And then when I started at primary school, I realised this world of books. And I'd not been read to as a child, before school. Because we had no books in the house whatsoever. My parents loved the television.
Another nod.
Absolutely. And I got to school and I was like, oh my goodness me, there are books. And I just took off. And then I just was reading all the time. And then I discovered when I was 5 and a half, I can't believe 5 and a half, the mobile library.
Oh, yes.
And the mobile library used to stop outside my primary school at 3:30 till 5 o'clock on a Wednesday and came at 9 a.m. till 1 p.m. on a Saturday. Now, it was literally just at the bottom of my street where I lived. So from then on, that's where I would be found. On a Wednesday and a Saturday, I was in the mobile library. And the lovely librarian found me a little spot. And from the age of 5 and a half till 9, I pretty much read that mobile library.
Oh, my days.
Everything, like the encyclopedias, everything. And my parents didn't understand me. They were really shocked. They didn't mind because I was out of their hair, wasn't I, really, at the library. Yes. But they didn't understand and they just thought, why are you doing this? We don't get you. And then when I was 8, nearly 9, I realised Roald Dahl was writing Matilda. That's how old I am. And so I got myself a little job peeling potatoes at the local chippy. So I could afford to buy Matilda, and that was the first book I ever bought of my own, and I still have it. It's on the bookshelf downstairs, and I now, between my husband and I, probably got about 1,000 books. Mm-hmm. And then my parents, they just didn't understand. They just wanted me to put the telly.
So they weren't unkind.
They got very angry with me.
Oh, they did get angry with you.
They did.
It was a bit more than just ambivalence.
Yeah, because they said to me, look, why are you reading? You can't learn from that. You know, you're just going to leave school and get a job. So what's going on? So I would then pretend to watch the television with them. And then when they would go to bed, and then I was tired, go to bed about 7. And this is when I was at 9, 10. Then when my mum and dad would come to bed at 9:30, still don't know this, so I hope they're not listening. And then when they come to bed, because my dad had to be up at 4 a.m., to bed at 9:30, I'd sneak downstairs. Because the only room in the house that had heat in was the front room. God. So I then sneaked downstairs to study, and I pretty much did that throughout my entire teens. So I'm an absolute night owl. I do my best work at midnight. So between 11 p.m. and 1 a.m. is when I do my best work, and I've always been like that. And they just didn't understand.
Did your O-levels?
Yeah, GCSEs.
You thought you were older. When you did your GCSEs, who did you celebrate with?
I went to possibly the roughest school in Preston, and thankfully I met a little kindred spirit. I will say that I had a kindred spirit at primary school as well. If it hadn't been for Roxine, my oldest friend, who we just battled each other.
I've got a thing I do sometimes with callers.
Yeah.
When I'm trying to cut them off or slow them down, and I say, "Look, let me finish. I say, I'm going to have to wait for your autobiography to find out what happens next. But with you, I'm...
My husband jokes about writing my autobiography.
You should. I'm all ears. I'm here for it. I'll put you in touch with my publisher. Back to Roxine.
Roxine, she was also smart and from a difficult from a poorer background, and we battled each other for the SNP.
Yeah.
Now, SNP was maths boxes, and we were determined that we were going to get to the end of Blue Box before we finished primary school, before the last Mr. Greenwood's class, which is year six now. And we did. We did it in year four.
Amazing.
And but it wasn't for Roxine. She pushed me as well.
Pushed each other.
And then at high school, I had Raksha, who lived around the corner, and I became part of her wonderful Gujarati family. Her parents adopted me. And when I got my GCSE results, I celebrated with them, because her dad gave me £20 for every good GCSE I got. So I celebrated with them. And then...
Did mum and dad even not get that? They must have understood.
They did. Yeah. They did. But they didn't really... They didn't celebrate it with me. They thought I was now going to leave school, get a job.
Yes.
So when I said, no, I want to do A-levels because I want to be a doctor, they were like, what? You're a dustbin man's daughter. You don't become a doctor.
Oh.
And I was like, well, I'm going to be a doctor. But then I had to work, you see, at the cinema to pay board to my parents for when I was doing my A-levels and to pay to get to university, to college. And then, unfortunately, because I had to work so hard, first time round, I didn't get an A in chemistry. The first time ever I'd not got an A. So then I had to... I also did too many A-levels. And then I had to refit chemistry to get to medical school.
Right.
But then I did medical school. I've succeeded really well. But I was also, unfortunately, I was also the fat, smart kid, which is never the best thing to be at high school in this place. That goes back to other conversations.
You could have gone tri-topical today. You're now a doctor. You're now a doctor.
I am, but the best thing, the thing that makes me smile every single day is, I'm a very senior GP now, and I'm now also the lead for primary care at the medical school in Preston, which is a 5-minute walk from where I grew up, and the actual medical school building is built on the old playing field of my old primary school.
I've gone.
Well, I go every time.
You've got me.
My parents, I think, and that still don't understand me.
But they must be proud in it. Yeah, they must be in a kind of slightly baffled way.
But from the Matilda, the reason my friends call me Matilda is the first time we went to watch the stage show, they all started crying after the second number and looking at me going, oh my God, it's you. And I was like, yeah, it's me.
When I grow up. I mean, it is a beautiful stage show as well, isn't it?
It makes me cry.
It makes me cry every time. And my life couldn't be more different from yours. So.
But there you go.
So there it is. Hey, listen, your husband's right. There's such a cracking book there, Helen. I'm not even, and the title would be something along the lines of, you can't be a doctor, you're a dustman's daughter.
Yeah. I don't know anybody else who's dad's a dustbin man who ended up being a doctor, but I was the only person at my medical school. There's five of us in my year who didn't have paid for education.
Okay.
So you can imagine it was interesting for me. Medical school.
Yes, I'm sure it was, but my goodness me, I don't even have words to describe how just how lovely. And you should see my inbox, seriously. How's Roxine getting?
But my background makes me a much better doctor.
I bet it does, because you understand you can't be what you can't see, and you know the backgrounds that some of these people are coming from. How's Roxine getting on, do we know?
Roxine is amazing.
Yeah.
Roxine is, again, she's a high flyer and has done really well, and we're still friends. We still see
Raksha?
Each other regularly.
You still see Raksha in a day?
Oh, Raksha, yeah. Raksha, I adore. She's like my sister. Raksha lives in Birmingham. She's a dentist.
Oh, this is insane. This is one of my favourite calls ever. Make sure they both listen to this, won't you? We'll clip it up and send it out.
Honestly, my two oldest friends, and they're both amazing, honestly. I'm so lucky.
Well, so are they. So are they, Helen. Mm. And if you do ever get round to wanting to write that book, and you need a little, you know, you want a bit of help from someone who's been there, you probably don't need it. I'm sure you know loads of people with publishing connections and contacts.
But
stay on the line. Get the email address off... off Eleanor, and then if you do want me to put you in touch with anybody, I'd be proud to help.
Oh, thank you.
All right.
Take care.
You too. It's 10 to 1.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
The Home Secretary insists Crowborough Asylum Centre is safe. Speaking on Holocaust Memorial Day, she also said British Jews shouldn't live a smaller life through fear. And ICE in the UK. Do you want it?
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
I'm Leah, and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right, and my GP referred me to the CDC. Had some blood tests done, and within 24 hours, I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
And when teams feel supported, they can achieve anything.
Sorry, just had even more of my teamer off ill.
Have you tried Benenden Health? It's easy to set up. They've got a GP helpline you can book 24/7.
Where were we?
A coffee break, hopefully.
Press play on your people's health with a wide range of healthcare services for less than £16 per employee per month. Search Benenden for Business. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
You're really building that business, Josh. That's because you chose to bank with Virgin Money, earning cash back on your supplies, turning expenses into rewards on everything from Sanders to skip hire. He came, he soared, he conquered. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus. Terms and exclusions apply. Cashback rate of 0.25% backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name of Clydesdale Bank PLC.
Imagine your dream holiday made possible by comparing cheap flights on Kayak. Walking on an unspoilt goes on for miles beach on the Sardinian coast. Plunging into the splendour of an idyllic lagoon in Greece. Ah, yes. This is the life. All you have to do is actually book it. Don't holidays. Use Kayak to compare prices from hundreds of travel sites and airlines to find your dream deal. Search Kayak and go see for yourself.
This is 40-year-old Kathy, mother of two and self-confessed telly addict.
Ready? Oh, look at you. That's brilliant. Well done.
This is also Kathy, working as part of a team to keep things calm at her local prison. Helping someone's son write his first letter home in 8 months.
Well done, you should be really proud.
Thank you, miss.
An extraordinary job, done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with James O'Brien.
12:53 is the time. I just heard the most inspirational call on LBC, says Terence. I'm a few minutes behind, says Jane, but I'm grinning from ear to ear listening to Helen. I'd love to read her story. That lady, writes Margaret, must write her book. I'm in tears listening to her recount her life. What wonderful memories. And this is my favourite call I've ever listened to, says Lauren on JOB. I could have listened to this story of aspiration and thirst for learning forever. Skip the news, James, and get her back on. Well, always leave them wanting more, Lauren, I think is fairly solid advice. But I meant what I said about the book. And I'll keep you posted if there are any movements in that space. Although I think it's fair to say she sounds pretty busy. Steve is in Chelmsford in similar territory. Steve, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. So thank you for taking my call, because I usually listen in the middle of the night and I've been listening to you a lot daytime. And I had to pick up the phone because basically my wife and people around me say that I've got an inspiring story. Oh. So I was brought up, and I'm trying not to get emotional, I was brought up by my grandparents after an abusive relationship. Oh. And it was clear from early on that I was bright. But my grandfather and my uncles and aunties, my grandfather was a grafter. He got up at 5 o'clock in the morning. He came back at 7 o'clock at night. Food was on the table.
Yes.
And I was to work. If I wanted to learn, I went to a YTS scheme.
Gosh.
So at the age of 14, I was setting up market stalls before school, then after school, putting them away and doing paper round, and I was giving board and lodgings while I was still at school.
Blimey.
Now, I wanted to. I decided at the age of 15 I wanted to be a nurse or a paramedic. heaven forbid, what are you? Some kind of, I don't know if I can say the word, pufter?
You've said it now. I'm not sure, really. I think that is actually offensive, and you've apologised, and I will apologise as well, but you are recounting an event from your own life and the word that was used in context. So apologies to anyone who's offended by that word. It certainly wasn't Steve's intention.
No. And so it was like I wasn't a man if I wanted to be in there. So I say that. Yeah. I wasn't a man, shame and everything. But I was determined to. And sadly, my grandfather passed away tragically at the age of 15. And I then became a full provider for my grandmother, but I was still determined to. And I went to college. And I struggled with the qualifications because I was doing four jobs, full-time carer for my grandmother.
Flipping heck, mate. And you put in a shift. I'm conscious of the time, so let's nudge to where we are now, if I may, Steve.
So now, after being homeless from the age of 18 on the streets, overcome addiction, mental health, I'm now married with a wife in a full-time security industry, but I still fulfilled my dream because I'm a volunteer first responder. Oh,
fantastic. Bless you. No, seriously, they're right. It is a story that deserves a wider telling, and I would give you more room to tell it if I didn't want to also get this story on the board today, because it is, as you know, Holocaust Memorial Day, and it always makes me think of this woman, Lily Pohlman, who I was proud to call a friend, and I met as I met you. Through this radio programme. She used to ring into LBC and I got her on stage at Full Disclosure a few years ago before lockdown to tell the story of how she avoided the Holocaust thanks to the kindness of strangers. But this is a little bit from before that, when the full horror of what was on the horizon began to emerge. And I think this story is important because of what it tells you about people that you already know when the horror starts.
We had Ukrainian caretaker where we lived, who, when the Russians first came, he became a militiaman, Ukrainian militiaman. When the Germans came, he became a German policeman by that, all right?
Yes.
Okay, but he rather liked my father and used to come up and see this and that, like the radio, how do you do that? My father could do everything very well with his hands too, and so he was sort of friendly. And then he kept coming and saying, you know, I rather like your watch. And what do you say when somebody says, I like your watch? You say thank you or something. Yeah. I mean, and then another time, I like your watch. And then the third time, my mother said, give him that watch. Yeah. It wasn't funny. Give him the watch because this is what he wants.
Oh, God.
And my father said, I don't see any reason why I should. This was a present for you, my birthday from you. Why should I give him the watch? Because, you know, women, I must say that women were smarter than men in those days.
That's why I laughed. I thought that was...
I'm telling you. Because men are straight, more straight women, you know, they were...
He did not
give him the watch. And on one fine day, on the 15th of August, 1942... he brought the Gestapo, and the Gestapo took them, my father and my little brother, age six, and we were not there, my mother and I, and they disappeared off the face of the earth. My mother went to him. I mean, she was so brave. She was so brave. Decided we were looking for them. And so she went to him to ask him, do you know what happened? What happened here while we were not here?
To the caretaker.
And she opened the door and he was standing with the back to the door. And he had dark hair like my father and about the same stature, wearing my father's silk shirt, his flannel trousers, the watch on his hand, and the radio is playing there. And it's a miracle that he didn't take her away also.
Why do you think he didn't?
I don't know. Maybe he was so shocked. I don't know. it was a shock to her. He turned around and was dead.
You can hear the entirety of that interview with the late Lily Pohlman on the Full Disclosure podcast series. That's it from me for today. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thanks very much indeed, James. Off the back of listening to Lily there, the Home Secretary says British Jews shouldn't live smaller lives, as she put it, because of anti-Semitism. Do you, have you been, a survivor of the Holocaust and the granddaughter of a survivor, share their stories for Holocaust Memorial Day a little later on the programme at 3. We have a deportation force of sorts in the UK attached to the Home Office. Do you want it to be more like the American one, ICE? But we start with Shabana Mahmood and her comments this morning about Crowborough Asylum Centre when she was talking to Nick Ferrari on LBC. She insists it will be properly policed. Local people are not so sure. We'll hear from one of the local campaigners in just a moment.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. The Home Secretary has admitted more people have arrived in Britain than have been returned to France in the one-in, one-out scheme. It's been revealed 350 people have arrived into the UK since August, while 281 migrants have been returned to Calais. Shabana Mahmood has rejected the suggestion the agreement has failed and told LBC they are ramping things up.
It was always a pilot and it was designed to try to prove that this new model of working with the French could work. It started off very small and very slowly because, of course, the French authorities and us were concerned about whether we could just physically handle implementing the pilot and whether we had the right infrastructure in place. So we've learnt lessons as we've gone along, as have the French.
So the numbers will grow?
The numbers will grow. They are already growing.
Ms Mahmood has defended the use of a former military barracks in East Sussex to house asylum seekers. Firefighters have rescued people from cars stuck in floodwater as heavy rain hits parts of the UK. Storm Chandra is also bringing strong winds and snow to places. Forecasters say flooding and travel disruption are likely to continue into tomorrow. The King and Queen are hosting a reception at Buckingham Palace to mark Holocaust Memorial Day. They've invited survivors and their families to mark the 81st anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. Daniel Walker is the rabbi of the Manchester Synagogue, where worshippers were killed in a knife attack in October. He's told LBC resilience and positivity shown by his congregation is helping the healing process.
In many ways, I'm trying to forget large amounts of it as part of my own personal journey. But of course I do remember it very, very, very vividly. And I remember the bravery of people, of good people. And I remember the response of good people, and that heartens me.
A murder investigation has begun after the body of a man was found in the River Neen in Peterborough on Saturday. Officers were called to an area near to Town Bridge following reports a man had been chased and entered the river. And ground rents will be capped at £250 a year in England and Wales as part of major housing reforms. New leasehold flats will be banned and existing leaseholders will get the right to switch to common hold. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 44 points at 10,193. The pound buys $1.37 and €1.15. LBC weather, heavy rain pushing north and east with hill snow in the north, turning drier with some brightness and showers in the south, very windy with gales in the north and west, a high of 11 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello,
Hello there. Good afternoon to you. It's Holocaust Memorial Day today, and I will be reflecting on that in various ways between now and four. Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, alluded to it, didn't she, in her conversation with Nick Ferrari at breakfast this morning. But speaking to, which we will talk about a bit later, but speaking to Nick, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, also spoke about the Crowborough training camp, so-called, the asylum accommodation that it is being turned into to house asylum seekers. She revealed in the conversation that she hadn't yet spoken to the Sussex Chief Constable about the policing of Crowborough and the concomitant tensions about it that exist within the community. This is despite vocal and expressed local safety concerns. Take a listen to what she said.
Look, I know this is difficult. Yes. There are no easy answers here, and there is no one silver bullet. I wish that there were that I could implement and make these problems go away overnight. But we will get out of asylum hotels. We do need a solution for housing asylum seekers. And I do think military sites presents a good solution going forward. Of course,
well, I'll come back
the
to
main
Sue
job
the...
is dealing with the boats, which I'm also trying to do.
We'll talk about that in a second, if we may. Why was it deemed necessary that the first arrivals, 27 men last week, were brought in at 3:30 in the morning? Why was that?
We always start with small numbers whenever we are moving people.
It was under cover of darkness, wasn't it, Home Secretary?
It was just designed to make sure that, of course, that there wasn't a public order risk, and also that we could move people safely and quickly. Whenever you move into any new part of an estate, you have to start small, and it is normal practice to do these things.
I have to make you aware of the strength of feeling.
When it's not busy. We are working closely with the police. We're working closely with the local authority.
So there are no additional safety measures?
Well, I won't go into operational details around the policing of the site.
Are there additional safety measures?
I have made sure that we are very alive as the Home Office, and also working with local partners about all of the potential ramifications for people, and that those measures are in place. So what I can reassure you is that we are working closely with everybody in the local area to make sure that those concerns are dealt with. And of course, I would expect the police and everybody else to be, policing this.
Have you instructed? I appreciate you're not going to tell me exactly what the patrols might be.
I can't go into that level of operational detail, but what I can tell you is I absolutely hear those concerns, and in our planning we are dealing with those concerns.
And you've had a conversation with the Chief Constable. You expect increased policing of some form in Crowborough?
I haven't spoken to the Chief Constable directly myself. I will do.
I don't know about you, but I think the arriving in the dead of night to avoid any community tensions or any difficulties is a mistake. I think it's, a government needs to be transparent. I understand that law and order and peace and all of that matters. Of course it does. But it seems sneaky to me. If I lived in that community, I'd regard that as them hiding things from me. I wonder whether you agree with that when we talk. And just so that you know, if you're not familiar with the plans around Crowborough, around 27 men have been housed at the camp already, arriving, as I said, in the dead of night, as Nick pointed out. The Home Office plans to accommodate up to 500 men in that bid to end the use of asylum hotels. Now, the reality is, of course, asylum seekers have to live somewhere. And if not the likes of Crowborough, if not hotels,